Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We'll be talking with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future about the Cat Food Commission's, I don't even want to call it a proposal, really a slap in the face. Really, I guess exactly what we expect out of them. The exact kind of, we created a mess. Now you need to, you poor people need to clean it up. We rich people, we created a mess. Now you poor working schlubs, get in there with your shovels and your brooms and your mops and clean up our mess. That's basically what it is. The whole proposal boils down to. We're going to cut taxes for us, the very wealthy. We're going to raise retirement age for working folks like you. We're going to cut some COLA stuff. We're going to make things much more difficult for you, but better for us because we're the very wealthy and we give you jobs. Yes. Yeah. They give us jobs, cleaning up their messes. And if you look at this, proposal, if you want to call it that, that's exactly what it is. And also today in the program, Mike Crossey, vice president at the PSEA, the Pennsylvania State Education Association, going to be here talking about the pension, because on Monday they're going to be voting on the pension reform bill, which, you know, there's discussion all around. I think it's a step in the right direction. You got to get something accomplished, because if the Republicans take over, and when they do, nothing but bad things can happen. That's just the way I see it. Nothing but bad. And if you looked in today's Patriot News, the Associated Press reported that the Republicans' big election victories in Pennsylvania and on Capitol Hill could be Christmas come early for the drilling companies that are rushing to exploit the Marcellus Shale, which we all know is the biggest known deposit of natural gas in the country, and some are even saying the world. They report Republican-elect Governor Tom Corbett is seen as a lot friendlier towards the industry. Gee, you think? A lot friendlier? Said he's never, ever going to raise taxes. Never, ever. But he's seen a lot as being a lot friendlier than Ed Rendell has been, who has clashed with the natural gas companies over both taxes and tougher new clean water regulations. So I think that sentence says an awful lot. What we're getting is a guy who is going to have a completely hands-off approach. The industry will be able to run amok. They'll be able to do whatever they want to do without really fear of any oversight, fear of any governmental intervention, and really any fear of having to pay for the destruction and the degradation they're going to cause. So, hey, good times ahead. They go on to say also the GOP takeover of the House will almost surely doom efforts in Congress to impose federal regulations on gas drillers. Among many Republicans, There is elation. GOP strategist Karl Rove told participants at an oil and gas industry conference in Pittsburgh that they can now expect a period of sensible regulations. You know, sensible regulations, like the regulations that were enforced down there in the Gulf when we had that huge spewing hole going into the water. That was a good time for regulations, right?
Wrong.
No, it was good. Good regulations. Good stuff. See, they police themselves. They cleaned it up. Come on. The incoming governor opposes any, no matter how sane and rational, any gas extraction tax on the industry. So congratulations, Pennsylvania. You are the largest gas drilling state in the country without an extraction tax. Don't you feel proud? Aren't you happy to know that you're allowing out-of-state companies and really international companies to come right into your backyard, destroy your woods and your forests and your land and your water and your environment so that they can suck all the profit out and leave the state with it? That's great stuff. They're promising cheap fuel to heat our homes. That's the promise. We're going to have all this energy, and it's going to power our businesses, and we're going to have cheap fuel at home, and everything will just be peachy and wonderful and keen. And my question is, anybody buying that? Because if you look in West Virginia, for instance, don't know if you've noticed, they're a very big coal-producing state. Not the cheapest thing in the world. Not everybody has wonderfully warm homes. Or am I missing something?
Incorrect. However, the stockholders, for the most part, are satisfied. The coal companies.
Yes, we got to worry about the stockholders. Always got to be worrying about the stockholders because they're sacrosanct. The profits for major multinational corporations, that's important. Important stuff. The damage that they're going to cause, don't worry about that. The disease and the contamination, the end of our water supply, don't worry about it. Where all this fracking fluid is going to go, don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. We don't need people. And I guess it's the typical Republican head-in-the-sand mentality, the pro-business head-in-the-sand mentality that if we don't know it's there, if we don't see it, it doesn't exist. Reminds me of when I was in high school, this is one of those not so proud moments in my life, but I came to school, let's see, how's a nice way of putting this? We went out for lunch, and, you know, like business people, we had a couple of cocktails at the lunch hour, and I came back to school schnookered, stumbled through the hall, and my English teacher, saw me. And the reason that there was this recognition moment is I was supposed to be sitting in the third row of her classroom while I was swaggering down the hallway, and she came to find me. Well, immediately I saw her and, you know, bolted towards the nearest exit and hid behind a fire pole. Here I am, this big hulking mass behind this tiny pole. And since I couldn't see her, I, in my drunken stupor, believed that she couldn't see me. And this is kind of exactly, you know, when I think of this, this is the Republican mentality. And while I was in that drunken stupor, it seemed logical that if I can't see her, well, obviously she can't see me. And this is kind of the same, in a way, the same thing. We're not going to pay attention. We're not going to have people pursuing diligently. Well, we'll have people who will announce a month in advance, hey, we're coming. Make sure you're spitting up the place and, you know, shine the little plaque on the wall that says how wonderful you are. But, you know, we'll be there in good time. But for the most part, head in the sand. For the most part, they are not going to be the overseers. They are not going to be the regulators of the industry.
Well,
that is a danger for
the
us.
Sad part is if it's not regulated properly, you know that in the future, could be a couple of years down the road, you know, you're going to have problems with water supply, you're going to have problems with the roads, and he's going to kick the cost down and kick that old can down the highway, and we're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, but here's the problem. It's not down the highway. It's right here. It's right now. There's a northeastern Pennsylvania town, Dimock, D-I-M-O-C-K. You can look it up for yourself. One of the big, and the AP points this out, a big hot spot for the Marcellus Shale drilling. Some of the residents there can't, they don't even use their wells anymore. They've been so badly polluted. They can actually light their water on fire as it comes out of the tap because there's so much methane that has seeped into their wells because of the drilling. And so much so that Rendell has said, you know what, Cabot Oil and Gas, you're going to have to pay $12 million to install water lines for these 14 families. Now, they're fighting it because they're saying, well, it wasn't us. It's not us. We wouldn't do that. We're a responsible driller. Must have been somebody else in the neighborhood. And we're going to spend an awful lot of money going after these people to clean up the mess. So when you look at this election that just happened on the 2nd, Tuesday a week ago, and you look at the fact that we've got a guy going to be sitting in the governor's mansion, took $1 million, $1 million from the natural gas industry, what do you think they're getting for it? What do you think the natural gas industry is going to be getting for that $1 million in campaign contributions to Tom Corbett? Well, I think his very first action speaks volumes. What he did is he made Christine Toretti. She is she's a national GOP chairwoman and the owner of a Pennsylvania drilling company. He made her co-chair of his transition team. If that isn't, and I'm big on symbolism. I'm big on that first decision that you make. I'm big on that because I think that sets the tone. When Ronald Reagan took office in 1981, one of the first things he did was tear the solar panels off the White House and ship them up to a college up in Maine somewhere. Sending that message to the big oil industry, hey, I'm your guy. This, to me, is the exact same thing. This is Tom Corbett saying, okay, I got the message. You gave me the $1 million. I got me elected. I'm your guy. I'm going to make sure that your profits are secure. And what frightens me, and it should frighten every one of you, is that we're going to be left holding the bag again. Every time these big industries, these multinational, multi-state industries, come up with a scheme, anytime they devise their plots, you and I pay for it. They walk away pockets full, fat and happy, and you and I are looking around going, well, wait a minute. Now what do we do? Oh, well, it's a crisis. We need to tighten our belts. Yes, we need to tighten the belts. Because that's what families do, and we need to sacrifice. Well, what about the guys who walked out of here with trillions of dollars worth of product? Because I'm telling you, that's what's going to happen as we move down the road. These big natural gas companies, they're going to walk out of here. They're going to saunter out of this state when it's all gone and leave nothing but a devastated mess behind them. Tom Corbett said, I look at this industry that's going to be here a long time after all of us in this room are gone. It's going to be a great industry, and we need to develop it properly. We need to develop it. We need to develop it, protecting the environment and growing jobs in Pennsylvania. Has he ever said how he's going to do that? How are you going to protect it with no oversight, with no money? Who's going to pay for that oversight? Because you haven't asked them for anything. Oh, yeah, you're going to come to us. Yeah, okay, yeah, I get that. I'm just not getting it. And here's what's interesting. And will wonders ever cease? And you gotta, and I try never to be too conspiratorial. But, you know, things just keep popping up where you go, man, that just seems too much for me. It can't be coincidental that Congress in 2005 exempted fracking water from the Federal Clean Water Act. It just doesn't seem a coincidence. And you got Bob Casey, who's the senator, soon to be senior senator here. He sponsored a measure that would subject fracking to regulations by the EPA. But hey, good luck, Bob. Not going to happen because the GOP is never going to go along with it. I'm saying never. And you look at the paper today, former governor Tom Ridge, now chief huckster for the drillers. He's got his guiding principles to the community because he's now working for him. Had an interesting piece in the Patriot News, one of those I see it as I see it pieces. Such flowery, glowing language on how wonderful this industry is going to be for Pennsylvania. And I'm saying, well, where are the jobs? Where are the jobs? I'm going to take a quick break. I'm right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Economist Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says the President's Deficit Commission appears to have largely ignored economic reality in developing the proposals it released this week. Baker says with more than 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, or having given up looking for work, the last thing that's needed are cuts that will lower economic demand. Baker says implementing the Deficit Commission's planned cuts would be like deciding that a plane with one engine already out needs the other knocked out as well. That's because the very government deficit spending that the commission wants to cut is propping up demand lacking in the private sector. Baker says the commission is misunderstanding the nature of current deficits, and that's led to a misunderstanding of the national debt burden. Baker says there's no reason the Fed can't just buy the debt and hold it indefinitely if need be. The Fed refunds debt interest to the U.S. Treasury. Baker says there's no shorter midterm deficit crisis, and he says Social Security has nothing to do with deficits, and it's a bad idea to cut Social Security because tens of millions of people depend on it for their income. And the commission, Baker says, appears never have even considered a financial transaction tax on Wall Street that could raise $100 billion a year. Commission co-chair Erskine Bowles is on the board of Morgan Stanley. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka happily announced Thursday that the National Football League Players Association has decided to affiliate with the AFL-CIO state federations and central labor councils in NFL cities. The AFL-CIO says this act of solidarity by football players is the kind of action needed to confront the issues all working people face. Grocery shoppers in parts of Washington state may want to do their Thanksgiving grocery shopping early because a strike could be on the horizon. Jesse Russell reports.
On Wednesday, 94% of voting workers gave the United Food and Commercial Workers negotiating team the power to call a strike if necessary. The strike would impact four supermarket chains who are currently involved in contract negotiations: Fred Meyer, QFC, Albertsons, and Safeway. Negotiations have been underway for more than 9 months, and they came to a standstill in late October. The specific areas of Washington that would be most impacted if a strike does become a reality would be the counties of King, Kitsap, and Snohomish. In total, the union is negotiating on behalf of 25,000 employees. Washington State hasn't seen a major grocery worker strike in more than two decades, and the last one stretched for nearly 3 months.
Production on season 11 of popular reality TV show The Biggest Loser came to a halt Wednesday as members of the crew walked off the job to demand a union contract. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees is supporting the workers who are seeking health care and pension benefits. According to Hollywood Reporter, who broke the story, the workers find it ironic that they're working on a show about living healthy, yet they aren't offered a health care plan. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages.
You know, that's kind of where they want us to go back to. Really stop and think about it. The classes that they're creating, the wealth class, they're secure. And you look at that debt commission. We're going to talk a little bit later with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future about this. But this debt commission, the proposals that they've come up with are just ludicrous. And the more I hear Republicans talk, the more I hear their ideas and their plans and where they're going to go, the more I know we, the working people, are screwed in this country. And we didn't create this mess. We really, honestly and truthfully, didn't create the mess. They tried to make it look like we did. They tried to say, well, it was the Community Reinvestment Act. It was those poor people. Those poor people, they wanted to buy homes. Those poor people, they took out more than they could afford. And I'm sitting here going, wait a minute. What do you mean those poor people? Who gave them the loan? Oh, yeah, the banks. Who benefited from it? Oh, yeah, the banks. Because who gets the properties back? Oh, yeah, the banks. And we bailed them out. We bailed those bums out. We had, what, the banks are in trouble? To the rescue! Open the checkbook, whatever you want there, brother. We'll spare a dime, a quarter, $10, whatever you need. But heaven forbid some guy who lost his job, heaven forbid that guy get a small amount to help him tide through the tough time. Heaven forbid. He's lazy and shiftless, doesn't want to work. Even though we know there aren't enough jobs out there. We know that for every open job, there are five people to fill that job. And that's not even talking about the structural problems or the frictional problems of unemployment. That's just talking pure, simple numbers. There are X amount of jobs that are being offered, and there are five times as many people for those jobs. And, there's so much going around this. And what is the Republican answer? Tax cuts for business. Oh, yeah, tax cuts will do it. Sure. Did great during the Bush years. Remember that? We handed out boatloads of money. And we're still talking about handing boatloads of money out to the very wealthy. In fact, we've got a whole, everybody's all upset. Oh, man. And us here, we talked about it a little bit. The fact that the president may cave, but while he was in South Korea, this is what he said.
With respect to the Bush tax cuts, what I've said is that I'm going to meet with both the Republican and Democratic leaders late next week, and we're going to sit down and discuss how we move forward. My number one priority is making sure that we make the middle class tax cuts permanent, that we give certainty to the 98% of Americans who are affected by those tax breaks.
Again, who's he fighting for? And this is where I'm going to support the president, because I do think he's been clear. I think some of his marchers, some of his supporters, some of the people who are out there doing some messaging for him might be a little off. And I do think at the end of it, he's going to have to cave. He's going to have to give in, because the Republicans will hold that 98% hostage so that the two can benefit. And I'm asking you this from a rational standpoint. Honestly and truthfully, a rational position. There's $700 billion we're talking about handing to the very wealthy. The top 2%. People who, I don't know anyone who will argue they need that money. I know nobody willing to argue the point that the wealthy need that tax break, that $700 billion. I don't know anybody arguing that. I can tell you what we can do with $700 billion. We could create jobs for the 98% of the people. The folks aren't going to get a tax cut. Why? Because they don't have a job. That's what we should be doing. And if private employers won't hire people and won't create jobs, the federal government has got to be the employer of last resort. Because we can't have people sitting on unemployment. You just can't have it. It's not good for society. It's not good for the family. It's not good for the family. Because, when the kids come home from school and there's dad still in his bathrobe because there are no jobs available, there's some psychological problems down the road. There's some family issues down the road. And we need to be that society where dad goes out into the workforce and has the... Look, I think about myself. If... Every day my kids were to look at me, and this is a personal thing, this is just me. I'm not talking for anybody else, and maybe Jake, you'll come along with me, maybe you won't. If I couldn't go to work every day, and I couldn't provide for my family with a certain level of certainty that there's going to be a roof over their head, food on their table, and clothes on their back, I got to tell you, I don't know that I could look myself in the face. And I don't know that I could be that role model, that figure that children need. And I think on some level, and I can't say this for certain, but that you would end up with withdrawing. Because you would have a lack of self-respect, a lack of dignity. And I think that's how most people are.
Self-esteem also enters into it, and then you take it to the natural progression. If at some point you feel that your family is really in danger, you can't provide. I'm not saying you particularly, but there are a lot of people who will do what they have to do. They will do what they have to do. If that means stealing, they steal. If that means doing things that are violations of law, even unethical, they will do it.
So it brings us back to the point of where's the smart investment? Where's the smart money? Where's the smart policy? Because as you're saying, look, you know, who knows what happens? If I got to go rob, steal, do whatever I got to do to feed the family, and maybe that happens. If you're desperate enough and you have a desperation class who they have nothing left to lose, maybe that happens. But as a society, how do we pay them? We pay by having to lock that person up. So then, because of that, that family now has somebody in jail that we're paying about $40,000 a year to lock up. Then you're going to have a family that's broken, societal problems right there through the out the wazoo. You're going to probably have to pay some welfare. You're probably going to have to pay some other LIHEAP and all the other things that go along with low income folks, and you have a broken family. And then what you start is a cycle. And what right now the social scientists are talking about is, look, if this keeps up much longer, we could start to see that generational cycle where folks fall into this rut and they don't come out of. So as I've said from the beginning, I thought that the stimulus bill, the Recovery Act, should have spent more resource, not on tax cuts, which 40% of it went to tax cuts, but it should have spent more money on creating jobs, creating dignity. And if you'll remember, Jake, and maybe you'll remember, the very first hope I had for this president is that he would be the figure in 5, 10, 20 years who we would look back on and say, that guy saved work in this country. Because that's been my greatest hope, that he's going to be the guy who saves work, that work is valued, work is rewarded. And right now we're not seeing that.
What you're referring to, and I'm sure, and this gets into some deep political thinking, I'm sure the Republicans felt the same thing, and they vowed that Barack Obama would not be a second FDR. And there are some similarities. They're frighteningly similar. And I believe the Republicans understood that if the first 2 years, as FDR did, made massive, massive changes in our country and got, and of course, it was a little bit different. The Democrats had an absolute stranglehold on Congress at that time. And he got a lot of his programs through the first 2 years, and I think they vowed that that would not happen with this president. And they were successful.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Ah, buddy Rush. But you're right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, they were against all of the social safety net programs right from the beginning. And they were against this president right from the beginning. Before he even took, before his hand was moving down on the Bible, you had people like Limbaugh.
I hope he fails.
You know, at the end of it, they said the right succeeded.
No, you had Sean Hannity claiming that it was the Obama recession before he was sworn in. Before he was sworn in. I mean, 20 years ago, we would have laughed. We would have thought, what is this, Comedy Central? But he was serious.
But the unfortunate reality is we've got folks who have some historical amnesia and don't remember that this whole collapse happened in September of 2008 because of, well, almost 8 years of Bush policies, 30 years of conservative supply-side voodoo Reaganomics. That's what got us here. And you need to remember that. As the people on the Cat Food Commission come with their scalpels and say, you know what? You working folks, you're going to have to work a little bit longer. You know, you're going to have to, we've got to tighten our belts. Things are tough right now. And when things get tough, Americans get tough.
And, you know, we're willing to sacrifice to save the country and la, 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 la. Hey,
how about sacrifice from the top? I'm willing to sacrifice like anybody else, as long as that sacrifice is equally shared. And I'm not talking about the guy behind me. I'm talking about the guy way up ahead of me, Mr. Billionaire. When I start to see the kind of sacrifice in my standard of living, when I see him taking that kind of sacrifice, I'm willing to come along.
Well, and then we look at the Bush administration. Not only did we have, you know, the economy was bad, we went to war. The Bush administration asked nothing of the American people. First time ever. What did he ask? Did he use his bully pulpit and say, you know, we all got to stick together here. We have to win this war. And this is what each and every American has to do to that effort.
Go shopping.
Basically. Well, you know, business as usual. La-di-da. You know, live your life. Basically, the message was, you don't have to sacrifice. We can do both.
Yep. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts about this? As you look at what the Simpson and Bowles committee has done, some of the ridiculous proposals that they've put out, what do you think about the Bush tax cuts? Do we extend it for the top 2%? Give them that $700 billion saying, go ahead. You know, you worked hard sitting on your yacht. You drank a lot of martinis for that $700 billion. It's yours. Take it. We don't need jobs. We don't need roads and infrastructure, schools, hospitals. We don't need health care for people. No, no, no. You need bigger yachts, longer martini breaks. That's what we need. And take a break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
With the media's preoccupation with Tea Party politicking and with the full force of raw corporate power suffocating our democracy, you probably haven't heard that many beacons of progressive hope are shining brightly from America's grassroots. These efforts show that well-organized alley cats can defeat the big money of the fat cats. Check out New Jersey, where the state AFL-CIO is not merely getting its rank-and-file members to support good candidates, but to become candidates. For the past dozen years, Jersey's Federation of Working Families has been recruiting, training, supporting, and electing its own members to state and local offices. In a state where campaigns routinely cost millions of dollars, the AFL-CIO spends a modest $250,000 a year to run a political boot camp that schools ordinary folks to be successful candidates. More than 160 of New Jersey's current office holders, including the state Senate president, are union members elected through this grassroots program. They learn the how-tos of speaking, media outreach, fundraising, and other basic democratic skills, all focused not merely on winning, but on enacting public policies to advance the middle class. The AFL-CIO president says, "We started with zoning boards, school boards, councils, then mayor, freeholder, and then senators and assemblymen. We take our members and apprentice them in the field of politics, just as we apprentice them in their own crafts," he says. The result is that labor no longer is a hapless outside group trying to persuade corporate-backed office holders to do the right thing for workaday people, but is now an inside player with real power to help set the state's policy agenda. This is Jim Hightower saying, why not do this in your state? For information, go to njaflcio.org and click on COPE.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Go on. Take it. Take it. All $700 billion of it. Fill your coffers. Invest overseas like you did with the last bit.
I mean, are we really that brain dead that we're going to say, here, the investor class, you need more money to go invest over in Asia and invest across the globe, everywhere but here? Because that's what they did. If you look at what happened with the Bush tax cuts, they didn't invest here. They didn't spend their money here. They shipped it overseas. And they helped drain the jobs from the U.S. When are we going to learn that Wall Street is not our buddy? We don't get to stroll down the street. We don't. We may have a couple of shares in our 401k, which is now about a little bit above 200.5. It's like 201, like 201. It's a 201k. Got a little bit of our money back. Not all of it, a little bit. But you know what? You stop and think of that for a second. How devious these folks can be. They took one little part of the tax code, 401k, get it, that was designed for wealthy people to shelter a good portion of their wealth. And they said, gee, you know, those defined benefit plans, I don't like being responsible for that. I don't want my company to have to worry about those workers once they're gone, once they're no longer productive for me. I don't want to pay for that. Don't want to make sure. Don't want to do any of that. We're going to set up their own little individual accounts, and we'll sell it to them like they're us, like they're investors, large investors who have their own personal account with a whole boatload of money. And I look at mine, and I've got about right now about $60,000 in my 401k. Which, you know, was just a second, you know, I have a union pension, but as a nice gesture, the union and the company came together and agreed to allow me to put some money away, and I did a little bit, just so down the road I'd have it. And, you know, most people go, wow, you got $60,000 in your 401k. The reality is, people who, that's their primary retirement, $60,000 at age 43, which is how old I am, is nothing. You might be able to retire for, what, year and a half, two maybe, three, best. But that's what they've given you. Oh, you have all this money, this big chunk of money. And to us, you know, $20 in our pocket is a lot of money. People like me, I got to tell you, I got $20 in my pocket. I'm a happy guy. You look at that number, oh, I got $60,000. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what folks who that 401k was designed for. But what they did is they sold it to us. They sold it to us as, now you're part of the investor class. You have a piece of Wall Street. No, you don't. What you have is a situation where we got some money in an account that they borrow from every so often. And when the market crashes, we're not able to get our money out of it fast enough to avoid the really negative stuff. And that's what happened with Enron. Look what happened to the workers at Enron. All those people lost everything. Why? Because the company said, well, we're only going to give you company stock. That's how we're going to fund your 401k, give you company stock. And when the company tanked, they couldn't move their money out fast enough. They lost it all.
And if you talk to, this I know a little bit about, you talk to any financial advisor worth their salt, they will tell you, when you're talking about a retirement fund, No stock. You should buy no more than 5%.
Well, you talk to any little old lady from the Great Depression who'll tell you, well, you know, honey, don't put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, it was logic back then. It's just as smart now. But you don't. You're right. You don't buy large percentages of stock for your 401k or for any investment. But that's what they did. But more devious than that, they got us looking at that Dow number. They got us looking at the up and downs of the stock market, and they got us thinking voting wise, who's best for the stock market? That's the dangerous part, Jake. That's the part that scares me. When you've got working people who've got maybe one chip in the game, maybe, and I'm being generous, maybe one chip out of a trillion. You got that guy thinking that, well, I got to protect my investment, my one chip in the game. So I'm going to vote against my own best economic interest and protect that one chip. And, oh, I'm not going to vote for those unions. I would never do that. But we know that union people have generally defined benefit plans.
Although we're seeing more and more that they're having to give that up because, you know, the private sector has decided that the 401k is better. And why do you think that is? Why do you think the defined contribution 401k is what corporate America decided that you, the working person, should have? Why do you think that is?
It's a huge shift in income. Huge shift in expense to, oh, I don't know, you, the people who make their profits.
And
huge.
You can jerk it around. You know, you don't, all those baby boomers, I mean, you retired before everything collapsed. But
at the wrong time, actually.
Well, but here's the reality. We've got a demographic problem in this country. If your generation retires at 62, 65, like they're supposed to, we got a lot of jobs that are going to be open and nobody can fill. What do? They got to keep you working, so we're going to destroy that. We're going to let that go away, and now you got to keep working until you die.
Well, if you go back even it's even worse than that, Rick. The picture you painted was absolutely accurate. But originally, the management people said, "Hey, you know, here's a nice little way." And you articulated about that. Here's a nice little way of hiding awful lot of money, and we can invest pre-tax dollars, and that's a nice little thing. And the government said, "Okay, we'll allow you to have that. However, you have to offer that to your employers." And then some of the employers said, okay, if we have to do that, why don't we replace our defined benefit plan with a defined contribution? It's going to save us a lot of money.
And it's going to shift responsibility from the entity that could ride the storm out, a corporation that never dies, to someone who doesn't have the broad shoulders. And once that money runs out, then what? And that's the other question that we never hear people talking about. If we continue to freeze Social Security and lessen the COLAs, the folks who are retired, what happens to them? Because it's obvious that we can't ask the very wealthy to contribute anymore. That's obvious. It's obvious that the wealth class is sacrosanct in this country, and somehow we have some bizarre pride in the fact that we've got a wealth class, an aristocracy in this country that is worth, I think the last Forbes 400 was almost $1.4 trillion between 400 people. You can't have that kind of concentration of wealth. And really the globe is going through this. The Europe is going through it right now as well because their wealth class got greedy like our wealth class. And they're going to try and do the same thing that we're doing, make the people who had nothing to do with it pay for it. You know, so when I talk to my Tea Party friends and I say, look, you know, you didn't cause this problem. I didn't cause this problem. But we're going to fight over it and we're going to fight over who's going to pay for it. And there should be no question who pays for this mess. It should be the people who created it. So when you see these Wall Street executives getting 30, 40, $50 million bonuses and paying 15% tax on their capital gains when they made $4 trillion, like Tepper, paid 15% on $4 billion. When a guy who swings a hammer for a living, works his butt off to make 100 grand, pays 28 to 30%. Explain the logic. Explain the fairness in that to me, because I'm not getting it. I am just not getting how the Tea Party can look at that scenario and go, that's what we want. You know, I hear people say, well, you know, the wealthy, they work for their money. Yeah, so does the guy who swings a hammer. So does the woman who drives my kids to school on the bus. So does the teacher who puts up with all of the parents and all of the administration and the attacks by idiots like that ball-headed kook over at the think tank. You know, they work hard too. Shouldn't they make a decent, reasonable living with a secure pension? Shouldn't they? You know, why is it we have this love of the wealth class? This, do you think we're going to get there swinging a hammer? You think you're going to get there shouting into a microphone? No. You know why I'll never get there? Because I'm not willing to sell you out. That's it in a nutshell. I'm not willing to tell you that, oh, private corporations are wonderful. We should never ask anything from them. Yeah. You gotta see this from a worker's perspective. And as we look around the globe and we see these austerity programs that the UK is putting into place, that Spain, Greece, all these countries are putting into place, screwing their working class, that we're going to be doing here in this country to stick it to the working class. And not asking anything from the aristocracy, the privileged wealth class. Oh, what are your thoughts on this? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. I think quick break. We're right back after this.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
As you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
You know, I look at this, and 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I look at this, and the big fight that's coming up here, Congress is going to be back in session in a couple of days, and the big fight is going to be unemployment. Going to be unemployment. On Monday, they're going to reconvene. And then on the 30th of November, that's it. You're going to see about 2 million workers, hundreds of thousands of people right here in this state who are going to lose their unemployment benefits just a month before Christmas. And, you know, you hear the right talking about, well, you know, business needs to be sure that, you know, they can invest with security, without risk. What do you think about these workers who've been out of work for more than 6 months? There are no jobs out there. What about them? What about their families? We don't talk about that enough. We honestly don't. And I've met some people who, you know, I don't know how they get up every day and go forward, especially when you have a media structure in this country that says, oh, the unemployed are lazy. When you've got a governor who ran on and won by saying that, you know, they're just people out there too lazy to go to work. Because we all know one guy, and we do. We all know one person who somehow milked the system. We all know that one guy. Just like we all know, we all claim to know that one person cheats welfare. And as I always say, you know, someone says, I know somebody who, you know, they cheat welfare. I go, really? I got their number right here on speed dial. Let's call and report them. Oh, we don't want to do that. You know why we don't want to do that? Because you don't know who you're talking, you don't know what you're talking about. I've yet to have, and I've said that to about 20 people. I've got the number to the welfare department right here on my phone. Let's call and report them. Oh, no, no, we don't want to do that. Well, then you're condoning them cheating. Well, no, yeah, you are. But anyway, on November, on the 15th, they're going to be reconvening. And I got to tell you, this unemployment fight, this is not only on the federal level, but here on the state level.
Well, the Democrats, once again, Rick, haven't done a good job in saying, look, unemployment keeps people from falling below the level they shouldn't, but beyond that, the multiplier effect. You're on unemployment. What are the chances of that individual in 95% of the cases of spending each and every dollar? They're pretty good. That's why you have them for every dollar. I think the number is $1.2 it creates. Because people simply are going to take that check and they're going to spend it within the community.
Because they don't have a choice.
That's correct. You're making my point. But the Democrats, I don't know, they just don't seem to, I don't know, use all the tools in their chest.
That car is getting, you know, that Cadillac is getting full. Because you got the welfare queen, Reagan's welfare queen, driving around in the Cadillac, eating steak, drinking Dom, sitting next to the family farmer who lost the farm because of the estate tax. And obviously we still haven't found that person either. Then now there's the, now we got this high-paid unemployment guy who's just living high off the hog and too lazy to work. And they're all just cruising around. And that must be what it is. They're cruising around. And they must be doing the speed limit because we're never catching them.
I know what it is. They're in the third dimension. We just didn't realize.
Is that what it is? But, you know, at the end of the road, this Bush tax cut thing is going to be a heated discussion. And when we're talking about, and the point here is when we're talking about kicking a couple million people off of unemployment, hundreds of thousands right here in Pennsylvania. At the same time, we're talking about going, yeah, we have huge budget deficits, we have huge debt, but we're going to give $700 billion to the top 2% of the people in the country who don't need it and really, you know, don't want it. I mean, there are some who don't. And I look at this group, Business for Shared Prosperity. We were supposed to have a guest today, but I guess that fell through. We haven't been able to get a hold of her. They point out in their press release today that the CEOs of the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce, not to be confused with the International Chamber of Commerce, the GOP hit squad. This is the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce. And the South Carolina Small Business Chamber of Commerce joined with the Business for Shared Prosperity and other business groups and small business owners around the country to urge President Obama and Congress to restore the top personal income tax rates to their pre-Bush levels. Don't borrow $700 billion for a counterproductive tax cut for the best off. And that's their point. And look, if we do this, what's it going to do for our economy? Because if your argument, and I would love to hear the argument, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I would love to hear the argument that tax cuts create jobs. Because I'll show you studies that it doesn't. The only thing that creates jobs, folks, is demand. Demand. People having a little money in their pocket, yes. Buying products. So if you're going to have a tax cut that is supposed to stimulate demand, you give it to people who spend it. So if you really wanted to stimulate demand, you would take that $700 billion and say, you know what? We're really going to do something with this. We're going to flip it from the top 2% because they're not going to consume that $700 billion and give it to the other 98% of the economy, to the working people of the country. Because obviously we're not getting wage increases. Everywhere I look, you're seeing companies that are slashing people's wages because they can. Because most of my friends are going, well, you know, at least I got a job. You know, we've taken 15% pay cut, our pension's frozen, our health care is getting worse, we're working longer hours, they're destroying working conditions, but, you know, at least I got a job. And things are getting tougher. Strains are getting harder on the working class. And all the only answer we get from the Republicans are, oh, Obama's a Muslim. Obama's a socialist. And we're buying it. We're actually buying this nonsense. Instead of saying, wait a second, Wall Street screwed this economy over in the worst way. They robbed, pillaged, raped, and stole, and didn't even leave a crumb behind. And now I got to pay for it? I got to tighten my belt? We got to cut unemployment compensation for people who need it. We got to cut the amount they get. We got to cut the eligibility so it's harder to get for folks. Explain the logic in that. At a time where we're still talking about going, here's the golden goose. You can have the golden goose.
Give you an idea. We talk about the tax cuts that the Republicans want to extend. Let me just throw out one category to give you an idea what we're talking about here. Those who make $500,000 to $1 million, and they certainly aren't the wealthiest, but they're up there. The Democratic tax cut under their proposals would be about $6,700. Do you have any idea what it is, Rick?
I don't.
Just guess.
$63,000.
$17,467, 2.5 times what the Democrats would be offering. That's just for those who make $500,000 to $1 million. You make more than that, you're rewarded even greater. Those are the kind of senseless, needless spending that we're throwing down a rat hole because of political philosophy. And at the same time, they don't want to extend unemployment compensation to hardworking people. We are told you need to be responsible. You need to go out and work and support your family, and these people have. And through no fault of their own, and the irony is, the very people who want to deny these people unemployment benefits are the same people who supported policies that sent their jobs overseas in the first place. It's a matter of simple justice.
And you look at the policies that did that. And the G20's meeting, and a little bit later in the second hour, we're going to be talking about some of the stuff from the G20. Because it's interesting how we have lost some of our strength. And we've lost that strength because we've given away our manufacturing prowess. We've given away a good portion of our strength. And you can make the argument on several levels of why we did it. You know, there's the old Kennedy theory that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. And I do believe the left bought into the neoliberal trade policies because they thought that they could pull the third world, the developing nations, out of poverty, and the entire globe would be like us. But I do believe the right said, "Hey, there's an opportunity to make a lot of cash here. We can exploit labor. We can exploit environmental concerns. Boy, we could just have the run of the table." And that's what they did. Because if neoliberalism worked, wouldn't Mexico be a very wealthy country? We're right back after this with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Economist Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says the President's Deficit Commission appears to have largely ignored economic reality in developing the proposals that released this week. Baker says with more than 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, or having given up looking for work, the last thing that's needed are cuts that will lower economic demand. Baker says implementing the Deficit Commission's planned cuts would be like deciding that a plane with one engine already out needs the other knocked out as well. That's because the very government deficit spending that the commission wants to cut is propping up demand lacking in the private sector. Baker says the commission is misunderstanding the nature of current deficits, and that's led to a misunderstanding of the national debt burden. Baker says there's no reason the Fed can't just buy the debt and hold it indefinitely if need be. The Fed refunds debt interest of the U.S. Treasury. Baker says there's no shorter midterm deficit crisis, and he says Social Security has nothing to do with deficits, and it's a bad idea to cut Social Security because tens of millions of people depend on it for their income. And the commission, Baker says, appears never to have even considered a financial transaction tax on Wall Street that could raise $100 billion a year. Commission co-chair Erskine Bowles is on the board of Morgan Stanley. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka happily announced Thursday that the National Football League Players Association has decided to affiliate with the AFL-CIO state federations and central labor councils in NFL cities. The AFL-CIO says this act of solidarity by football players is the kind of action needed to confront the issues all working people face. Grocery shoppers in parts of Washington state may want to do their Thanksgiving grocery shopping early because a strike could be on the horizon. Jesse Russell reports.
On Wednesday, 94% of voting workers gave the United Food and Commercial Workers negotiating team the power to call a strike if necessary. The strike would impact four supermarket chains who are currently involved in contract negotiations: Fred Meyer, QFC, Albertsons, and Safeway. Negotiations have been underway for more than 9 months, and they came to a standstill in late October. The specific areas of Washington that would be most impacted if a strike does become a reality would be the counties of King, Kitsap, and Snohomish. In total, the union is negotiating on behalf of 25,000 employees. Washington State hasn't seen a major grocery worker strike in more than two decades, and the last one stretched for nearly 3 months.
Production on season 11 of popular reality TV show The Biggest Loser came to a halt Wednesday as members of the crew walked off the job to demand a union contract. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees is supporting the workers who are seeking health care and pension benefits. According to Hollywood Reporter, who broke the story, the workers find it ironic that they're working on a show about living healthy, yet they aren't offered a health care plan. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I wish there was some rational thought and sanity on this deficit commission. And, you know, part of me says it's just a bunch of old codgers who have been angry that Social Security passed in the first place. People like Alan Simpson, who think that all of us are just a bunch of cows sucking off the government teat, all 310 million of us. At least that's what he said. And you look at this proposal, if you can call it that, very, very small cuts to defense, massive cuts for you and me. Reminds me of the tax reform bill of 86 that Reagan pushed through, where he raised the bottom income tax level, lowered the top one, cut out all of the middle class tax exemptions, and taxed unemployment benefits. You want to talk about a slap in the face? That is a slap in the face. I've got Dave Johnson on the line from the Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org is the website. He's done extensive writing on what they're calling the Cat Food Commission. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at this, and I'm flabbergasted. You know, how can you, at a time of massive crisis, say that we're going to give tax breaks to corporations and to the wealthy?
Well, Rick, we've got this huge deficit. And every one of us knows that the deficit came from cutting tax rates on the rich and these huge increases in military spending. So, of course, we've got to cut Social Security to fix it. I mean, what are you thinking?
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Sorry, missed that one.
But But you know what you missed in your list? This recommendation from the Deficit Commission, they're asking the rich to take some of the pain, too, you know. Did you not see it? It cuts tax rates at the top from 35% to 23%. It cuts taxes for the rich.
Yeah.
You didn't see that?
Yeah, but that's a burden. What are they going to do with all that money?
You know, Rick, I come on your show, and every time I come on your show, I start shouting. and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I better not do that tonight. I better try to not shout. And here we go.
Well, how can you not? I mean, honestly and truthfully, I mean, very seriously, how can you not look at this commission's proposal and not be furious and not be ready to run into the streets like we're seeing them do in Europe?
Oh, I know. And, you know, there's so many things that could have been addressed. And then there's one of them out there. There's a thing called a transaction tax, which is a small tax, maybe a penny or two, on financial transactions. That's all it is. But because of these high-speed trading things going on now with, you know, the Goldman Sachs and the big banks where they're gaming the Wall Street system, it's called forward trading. There's a bunch of names for it. But that would slow that down and actually make the financial system safer while getting tens of billions of dollars to help fight the deficit. That's not in there. You know, and you know that one of the two guys that came out with this, Erskine Bowles, a lot of people don't know, he's on the board of Morgan Stanley, or is it J.P. Morgan? Yeah, one of those.
Are you surprised?
So, well, I'm not surprised, but you've got to wonder how has Washington become this, you know? And, well, they're connected. They're connected to this huge rise in the wealth and income at the top lately, you know? And it's almost like they're saying, you look, that's what matters to us here, you know. That's who we serve now.
Did you not pay attention the last 6 months up until November 2nd?
I know. It's just astonishing. But there were so many things that could have been. And I mean, you know, people like Paul Krugman and others are saying, look, you know, you don't start talking about cutting the deficit with huge tax cuts for the rich. I mean, you can't be serious. You can't. They just gave, Sam, I'm getting ready to shout. See what you did? They just gave all of this money to Wall Street, and then the Wall Street paid out all of these bonuses, and we're supposed to sit here and accept these things that we're supposed to cut Social Security. Here's the thing, Rick. Social Security is a separately funded program, and by law, it can't borrow money. It can't contribute to the deficit. Social Security is not part of the deficit. Here's why they're always so concerned about Social Security when they talk about coming deficits. It's because when Reagan cut taxes for the rich, they raised massively the amount of money that working people pay into Social Security, and for that, Social Security was supposed to build up a huge trust fund.
Right.
And now it's got trillions of dollars saved up, all of it in treasury bonds. And what's happening now is some of the boomers are starting to retire, and not until 2037 does that trust fund even deplete. But because of the trust fund is in treasury bills, they have to start paying off some of those treasury bills. So what happened was the country borrowed money from Social Security, and now they have to start paying it back. And they're so afraid now that because they have to start paying it back instead of the Social Security money, that you are only middle class and lower people pay. The rich don't, you know, after a certain level, there's what's called a cap.
Right.
So they have to pay that back, and that's what they're concerned about. It's not that Social Security contributes to the deficit. It's that they have to find the money to pay that Social Security money back, and that's going to have to mean raising tax rates back up on the rich, and that's what they're afraid of. And that's why we hear all about how Social Security is a problem.
Well,
no, it's not a problem. It's paying back Social Security, what was borrowed from it, that's the problem.
You mean it's just not a bunch of filing cabinets with a bunch of IOUs? You know, because George saw them. George saw them down in the basement. They're there, filing cabinets, nothing but pieces of paper with IOU written all over them.
Well, you know, all of the U.S. Treasury bonds are these pieces of paper that say IOU, and the United States government has pledged to put their full faith and credit behind Treasury bonds. When they say the way to solve this is to just ask those greedy old people to take less for their retirement, you know, what do you get, $1,800 a month maximum or something, you know, $1,200 a month, to take less than that. Imagine living on that. But
my grandmother
less,
does. You know, here's the thing. My grandmother does. And I want to see Social Security solvent. I want to see the people who've robbed and pillaged it over the years. The Reagan administration, Bush, H.W. Bush, to a small degree, Clinton, and the little shrub. I want to see them all be held to account.
Yeah. Yeah. So that way, people got to understand when you're talking about Social Security as a problem, the only problem with Social Security is they borrowed all the money from it, and they don't want to raise taxes on the rich to pay it back.
That's it in a nutshell. And you know what bothers me about
this? Talk about cutting taxes on the rich instead of raising them. Oh, man.
But Dave, you're just engaging in class warfare.
Yeah. Well, there's been a class war, and we lost.
Yeah, I say the only jobs that we ever get, because I have a couple of people who call me and tell me that the very wealthy, they give us jobs. Anybody ever given you a job?
Hey, I have a post up at ourfuture.org that I just put up, and it's titled, Businesses Do Not Create Jobs. Think about this, you know, if you're in business for a profit, you're not trying to create jobs, you're trying to kill jobs. You've got these workers, they cost money. You don't, what you're trying to do is shed workers. You're trying to find ways to bring in computers, and I'm not complaining. I'm not saying businesses shouldn't do this, but people have to recognize businesses don't create jobs. What creates jobs is when customers are coming in the door, and business people see that, and they see business going unmet, they'll hire people. But it's demand that hires people, not businesses. Demand makes businesses hire people, but every incentive in a business is to try to pay you less or get rid of employees.
And that's something that, you know, most of the people that I talk to don't seem to grasp. I keep getting this frame that, you know, that big business gives us these jobs that, you know, we don't actually do anything for them. They just give them to us out of the goodness of their heart. This benevolent corporation, these wonderful people who have come together to form a corporation for the purpose of giving away jobs.
Yeah.
I have people who believe that.
They're the job creators, and you should get down on your knees because they create it. Anyway, now you're going to get me shouting. See, you did it again.
Well, but, I mean, but at the end of it, you know, the theory was, and it, correct me if I'm wrong, because I think it was a failure, but if we give all the money to the people at the top, this idea that somehow it's going to trickle down on the rest of us and all this wonderful prosperity is just going to come raining down on us like rivers of honey from above, it hasn't happened yet.
Did that. How many jobs did we get in the Bush years? I think the net job gain in the Bush years was zero, but Bush gave these huge tax cuts to the rich.
Yep.
And now there's these big corporations are sitting on, I think it's $2 trillion of cash, and they're talking about giving them more cash. Well, you know what they're going to say if you give them more cash? They're going to say thank you. But they're not going to hire anybody until people start coming in the door, and they're not doing anything. See, I'm shouting. You did it. Okay. They're not doing anything to get those people coming in the door again. You know, they could be hiring people to retrofit buildings to be energy efficient. You know, our infrastructure hasn't been maintained, well, since Reagan did those tax cuts because they didn't have the money anymore to start to keep fixing roads and bridges and stuff. There's trillions of dollars of infrastructure maintenance that needs to be done. We've got millions of people out of work, and the government can borrow money now at the lowest rates ever. And I mean, there's a natural equation there, because if you put those people back to work, they're paying taxes, they're going to stores, they're going in the doors again, and because you've got them working on infrastructure projects, that makes the economy more efficient so that the people in the other countries, you know, where more our companies can be more efficiently selling outside of the country instead of importing everything.
You know, here's the thing, in a very articulate fashion, so that even a dumb truck driver like me can figure that out. Why is it the people in Washington haven't figured it out?
Well, we have a problem that, and this is in part of the end of that post I wrote, by the way. It's called Businesses Do Not Create Jobs, and it's at ourfuture.org, that the government is captured, the word they use when it's captured. If you let a business influence government at all, then obviously that business is going to influence the government to give it more money. And so they have more money to influence the government with, so they're going to influence it more. And so pretty soon, you know, you're in this situation where the entire system is captured by those with the most wealth. And so the problem was when we started allowing those with wealth to have more influence over the government than the rest of us, we lost democracy, because democracy is one person, one vote, and not $1 one vote. And we turned into a $1 one vote system. And that's what you saw. I was in Pennsylvania before the election, and I was watching those ads, those horrible ads, one after another. And you don't even know who's placing the ads, but they're smearing people. And it, you know, that's what happens.
And it
that
worked.
Money.
And it worked. You know, we got a governor now who has said never ever is he going to raise taxes. Never ever is he going to tax the drillers who are coming here to suck the natural gas out of our ground. Never ever, never ever. That's what he said.
Yeah.
Got a million dollars from the industry. A million bucks bought that. That's cheap as far as I'm concerned.
They had one in Oregon where they had a hedge fund guy put in millions of dollars against one member of Congress. Well, you know, usually in Oregon, a couple hundred thousand dollars to run a race. He put in millions just to run ads to smear this guy because he had supported reforming Wall Street. In Kentucky, a guy who runs a chain of nursing homes that was being prosecuted by the attorney general of the state. Well, that attorney general was running for the Senate, and this nursing home chain guy put in millions and won to defeat him. So now he's not going to get prosecuted.
Nice.
So we've opened up our system to money, and once you open it up a little bit, it just brings more money to those people that will use that money. The answer is that people have to stop listening to the ads and have to start talking to each other. We've got to organize. We've got to organize outside of the political parties to stop this influence of this money.
Yeah, because, I mean, to be honest, the Democrats were almost as bad. Not as bad, but Republicans take note. Your turn could be coming because corporations don't care which side of the aisle you're on. All they would know is they want their piece of the pie, and they're going to pay to get it. And here in this state, Tom Corbett got $1 million. It's not a lot of money when you're talking about $7 trillion worth of wealth underneath the people's feet here in Pennsylvania.
Let's imagine a hypothetical war because it's not just all corporations doing this. It's corporations. In this case, it's largely been oil companies, which is why you hear so many politicians down on alternative energy and stuff. But suppose, imagine a war between Apple and Google or something. And so you've got these politicians who all got elected with Google money. Well, they better not feel like, well, that means the corporations are behind them, because that means next time the Apple people will be coming after them, you know? So that you're not even safe if you think, like what you said, the Republicans better not be so confident, because there's other money that could go after them, too. We've just got to stop all the money.
I'm right there with you. Last thing I wanted to talk to you about, Dave. Can you stick around? I got to take a break.
Yeah, I can
right
stick
here.
Around. No problem.
Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. Stick around.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Saving work. Work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You could have a big difference. Going up and down, all around the bends. You could have a bunch of 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I'm here with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, talking a little bit about the Cat Food Commission, some of the nonsense, this ridiculous proposal. And I'm not even going to call it a proposal, just a piece of trash. Dave, I appreciate you sticking around for me.
Thanks. I'm here.
You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on over in Korea with
sure.
with the G20 and the Korean free trade agreement that they keep trying to ram down our throat. Another bad, in my opinion, bad Bush era trade agreement. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, you nailed it right there. This was another treaty that was negotiated by Bush. NAFTA, when Clinton came in, there was the NAFTA treaty that had been negotiated by the other Bush and that crowd. And here's the thing. I used to have a company, and we sold, it was a software company. Trade, international trade can be a great thing for everybody. You know, if you have a company and you're selling in the United States, that's great. But if you can then open up to being able to sell, you know, around the world, all of a sudden you've got these huge markets to sell into, and it's great. And that benefits the people on the other end, too, because they can get things they couldn't get before. They can sell their stuff to you, and you can lift each other. But they put some things into these free trade, they call it, agreements. And you can look at charts of what happened to the United States with Reagan when they started opening up these free trade agreements. What they did was they put in that labor rights, okay? They did not protect labor rights. And we have fought hard as a democracy, you know, we fought the king's corporations. That's really the foundation of this country, was that we were this colony that was just supposed to produce raw materials, and we weren't even allowed to make things here. Through the centuries, we built up these protections where we could have a good life, where we shared, where we had minimum wages, you know, we allowed unions, all the things we did. And then along they came with these trade agreements that enabled them to then evade those protections by just moving a factory across a border to some place run by thugs that the people aren't allowed to negotiate for wages. They don't have worker safety. They don't have environmental protections. And they said, ha ha, your protections mean nothing now. And if you want to keep, you know, you're going to have to initiate lower prices. We're going to get rid of your union, whatever it takes to get us more profits right now. So they would ship these jobs to other countries. They'd close a factory and just move the machines to another country, make the same stuff and bring it back. They evaded our democracy. And see, now I'm shouting again. Rick, what do you do to me?
No, so, you're not shouting. I mean, I'm the one who's incensed about this. Last night we talked about 18 iconic things my childhood, really, that used to be made here in the U.S. and no more. I mean, Chuck Taylor's, Chucky's not made in the U.S. Rawlings baseballs haven't been made in the U.S. for a long time. Etch and Sketch, you name it. Blue jeans, for the love of Pete. What's more American than a pair of blue jeans?
Everybody wants to be able to go to stores and see Made in America again instead of everything made in China. And I'm not knocking Chinese workers, but they aren't able. They can't leverage their situation to lift themselves up and their wages up and start getting good wages yet. You know, their government is not very conducive to that. Now, there's two sides of the Korean agreement. One side of it, if it is, it helps us start to crack that Chinese thing. There's various parts of it that could help with that because it's very technical stuff, but it leaves out the worker protections. It's got very tricky language about the International Labor Organization, whether they'll go with the labor organization's declarations or conventions and little things like that. And those were left out of it. The big holdup on the agreement was that Korea just will not let American car companies sell in Korea. And they've spread this stuff about mad cow disease so Korean people won't buy American beef. Those were the two big holdups. But right. It turns out, you know, that's a really good thing that those help things up, because now we have time to, as they keep working on this, to get labor protections in it. So we don't just ship jobs to people who are paid terrible wages and aren't allowed to negotiate or where they ruin the environment or something, which gets around everything we fought and built with our democracy.
You know, and in reading some of the articles from the Korean trade unions, they don't want it either. Because they see it as a race to the bottom. Because in a lot of aspects, we're right now beginning to pull other countries down.
Right, exactly, exactly. You know, Germany's opening up car plants here because we make so little now that it makes more sense because, you know, they get 5 weeks vacation, they get health care, they get early retirement, they get the full European thing that the Republicans like to call socialism. But because they carefully manage their manufacturing and their trade, they're able to pay really well. You know, you get a good deal if you're in Germany, supposedly socialist, right?
Yep.
So the Korean trade agreement, it could be negotiated. People shouldn't just react to trade agreements as a bad thing because of how they scammed us with NAFTA. But it's got to be done in a way that protects workers. And then what happens is the workers over there can get paid well. And if they get paid well, they can buy stuff from us. Imagine that. If we had twice as many people able to buy our stuff as we have now, it would be great. Think what that would do for jobs here, you know?
Yeah, but
so
here's the thing.
It's going to be a great thing.
And this is what I've said from the very beginning. I don't have a problem with free trade agreements with countries like Canada or Germany or the UK, people who are on a similar plan. I don't have a problem with that. My problem is when you start looking at desperate nations and you're putting American workers against desperate workers.
Exactly.
That's my problem.
And, you know, we have market power. People want to sell to us. We're still this huge market. And we could say, you want to sell to us, you got to pay those people more. And that could be the terms of the kinds of agreements we make, you know. But because this started happening under Reagan, it was really all about how do we break the unions? How do we get our own short-term profits up? And, you know, when you sell the farm, you know, the old story, you sell the farm, you might make some money when you sell the farm, but you're not going to make any more money later. And that's what we're doing in this country. We have let Wall Street sell our ability to make a living as a country and as people. They pocketed the money from selling the factories. We don't have a way to make a living anymore. And that's what we've got to turn around. And fortunately, everywhere I go, I went on this tour of these manufacturing town hall meetings in Ohio and Pennsylvania and the whole region. And there were a lot of Tea Party types there. And one thing we've got on our side is that the day-to-day Tea Party person on the street understands how bad NAFTA got them. And they're on our side on these agreements, I think.
And we need to figure out how to organize that and work together on that. We may not agree on a lot, but the things we do agree on, I do think we need to come together on.
Yeah.
Last bit of questioning I've got for you. You know, in talking about the deficit and everything, the argument that I've been making is the big deficit that I'm worried about is not the budget deficit. It's our trade deficit. If our trade deficit weren't so huge, if we had trade policies that were, smart, equal, egalitarian, whatever word you want to use, I don't think our budget deficits would be as bad.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we also have to get tax rates on the rich back up, but that goes with it. But, yeah, you're exactly right. The way that you get out of these kinds of budget deficits is you make a living to be able to pay it off. You don't. This austerity stuff is shocking, you know, that they would think that they're going to be able to pay off our debt by laying people off is essentially what they're talking about with this austerity. What we did after World War II, we left World War II with a huge budget debt, but we didn't cut back. We built the highway system. We did the GI Bill. We did all kinds of things. And what we did was we invested and we grew the economy, and then we paid off the debt from the dividends of that investment by making the economy twice as big. Even if you just left the debt alone, that means that as a ratio of your economy, the debt has fallen by half.
Yep.
So that's what you need to do. You need to pay people more so they can pay taxes. You need to expand the economy, and we need to start having policies that take back this huge, huge concentration of wealth that's gone to the top. Even the guy who did those Reagan's tax cuts, the guy named David Stockman was Reagan's budget director. He's out there saying, shame on you Republicans, because it's just gotten so completely out of hand, this idea that government is bad and you shouldn't give it any money. You know, I mean, businesses grow in the infrastructure that we build. And I just saw a poll that Republicans are like 80% against investing in infrastructure now.
Yeah, because they think we can continue to live off the investments of our grandparents. Because if you look around, that's all that's going on. We haven't done much investing for our children. What are our children going to be left with?
That's right. The schools, the roads, everything. You know, it's time. We just got to take it back and rebuild the country and make a living again.
That's exactly it. Dave Johnson, Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. I appreciate your time. Great conversation, as always. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Remember, check out the website, ourfuture.org. Lots of good stuff there. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
With the media's preoccupation with Tea Party politicking and with the full force of raw corporate power suffocating our democracy, you probably haven't heard that many beacons of progressive hope are shining brightly from America's grassroots. These efforts show that well-organized alley cats can defeat the big money of the fat cats. Check out New Jersey, where the state AFL-CIO is not merely getting its rank-and-file members to support good candidates, but to become candidates. For the past dozen years, Jersey's Federation of Working Families has been recruiting, training, supporting, and electing its own members to state and local offices. In a state where campaigns routinely cost millions of dollars, the AFL-CIO spends a modest $250,000 a year to run a political boot camp that schools ordinary folks to be successful candidates. More than 160 of New Jersey's current office holders, including the state Senate president, are union members elected through this grassroots program. They learn the how-tos of speaking, media outreach, fundraising, and other basic democratic skills, all focused not merely on winning, but on enacting public policies to advance the middle class. The AFL-CIO president says, "We started with zoning boards, school boards, councils, then mayor, freeholder, and then senators and assemblymen. We take our members and apprentice them in the field of politics, just as we apprentice them in their own crafts," he says. The result is that labor no longer is a hapless outside group trying to persuade corporate-backed office holders to do the right thing for workaday people, but is now an inside player with real power to help set the state's policy agenda. This is Jim Hightower saying, why not do this in your state? For information, go to njaflcio.org and click on COPE.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
And when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Should go. I needed money because I had nowhere to go, and I ran for political office. That's how the song should go. I ran out of money, and I ran for Senate. I broke the law, and I'm going to jail. Seems Christine O'Donnell. You didn't think she was going to go away, did you? You didn't think she was going to hang out in the corner with a box of Kleenex, did you? No. No, not going to happen. It turns out, according to the Washington Bureau of the News Journal, there has been a campaign finance complaint by the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, and the Delaware Republican Party. They filed a charge back in September that's still pending against Christine O'Donnell. Federal prosecutors in Delaware are reviewing CREW's complaint that O'Donnell used campaign contributions for personal living expenses, according to Kim Reeves, a spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Delaware. She declined to comment on the status of the review, but it is under review, as all complaints are in the district, she said. CREW and the state GOP, the state Republican Party, filed complaints against O'Donnell. Why? because she was using money that for personal gain. They knew this was trouble. The state Republicans said, hey, honey, can't do this. Bad stuff. Days before the primary, the state party asked the FEC to investigate whether O'Donnell accepted excessive contributions from Tea Party Express Political Action Committee and coordinated communications with the group illegally. And, you know, I know what people are going to say. Well, you know, she's just one of us. She's just a regular girl. She doesn't know all that fancy law stuff. She doesn't know that. She's one of us. Here's the thing. If you're going to run for political office, you should know the rules. I know Tea Party people hate rules, but without rules, you have chaos. Complete chaos. Anyway, Melanie Sloan, who we had on this program, you know, right after the story broke from Crew, wrote in an email, slamming me won't stop the FEC or the U.S. attorney from investigating, and it won't change the facts. O'Donnell illegally misappropriated her campaign funds. Everyone, including disappointed candidates, must be held accountable for complying with our country's laws. And, you know, I agree. And if I'm looking at this right, if I'm understanding this right, she used a boatload of money for her living expenses. She paid her rent. She paid, you know, meals out and, you know, all kind of stuff. So I'm kind of interested to see how this is going to work, Jake, because if she doesn't go to jail, which I think she should, I may consider running for, be a perpetual candidate for office. I'll just be perpetual, just like her. I won't have to work. I can have someone else pay my rent. That's kind of what's going on here, because if you remember, she only reported making $5,800 in the year before she ran. $5,800. How are you 41 years old and live on $5,800?
Well, she's reporting one thing and doing it with another. It's fraud. Now, here's my question. What does the code say as far as penalties? Is it just a slap on the wrist? Could she conceivably serve some prison term?
She should do.
And you know what? I wouldn't have any problem with her being slapped in prison for a while.
Yep.
If she violated the law.
Might get her a trade.
She basically stuck her tongue out at the law. You violate the law, you know, you do the crime. You do the crime, you pay it with time in prison.
Her campaign had $1.36 million on October 13th and a $247,000 debt. She could use campaign funds for her defense, but according to one of the legal experts, it could be very costly in the event that this investigation go further to the trial stage.
Well, she also has a big problem when it comes to a criminal trial. She wasn't paying her people. That is not conducive to people being happy on the campaign.
You mean that, you know, people need to be paid?
Well, her full-time staff, yes. That's why. That's their job. You know, you work for a living. In this case, you're working to get a candidate elected. You work for a certain salary, and if she doesn't pay you, that's not conducive to having happy people.
But it'll be interesting to see how she got away with it, if she gets away with it. Because, you know, I don't know how you live on $5,800 as a 41-year-old person. To be honest, she's never had a job. So how do you get to be 41 years old and never have a job? And yet you got people around this country who just, oh, she's just the wonderfulest. Oh, she's just wonderfulest. She's wonderfulest. Because they put ist or ism at the end of everything. You know, all people who would support
her.
Well,
I think some of the Tea Party supporters have conflicted someone who has never been a quote politician with someone who's totally, totally inept and totally, totally unqualified. They are separate and distinctly different. Now, unfortunately, I think some of these real diehards in the Tea Party don't really care about the facts.
Yeah.
All they know is she's one of us.
Yeah. Since you brought up unqualified, the roll call is reporting that the quitter former governor of Alaska, speaking of unqualified, her political action committee is being requested by the Federal Elections Commission to clarify some of her Sarah PAC deductions, including corrections to the Political Action Committee's year-to-date calculations of cash that it received, as well as cash on hand figures for the period that they're looking into. The FEC also seeks additional information on various expenditures by the campaign and shown on its October quarterly report on funding, fundraising services, and public communications or vote drive activity. Get this. She raised almost $5 million and spent nearly $4 million of it. She contributed to campaigns $276,000. Stop and think about that for a second. She contributed a little more than $250,000 on almost $4 million that she spent. What did she do with the other, $3.5 to $3.75 million? What can you say, line her pockets? Let's go to the phones. We got Christian on line one. How are we doing today, Christian?
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Yourself?
Good. I heard what you were talking about with the, as far as the you know, free trade agreements and all that stuff. And this is what really, when people talk about the Tea Party and the stuff they stand for, one of their mission statements specifically says to keep jobs here in the United States.
Okay.
And it just kills me that they themselves, because I think we can understand, but they themselves don't get that when a corporation is looking to increase its profits, purely increase its profits, and they head overseas to where you could pay someone a quarter a day to produce your, you know, product, or Lord knows what the rate is, but it's nothing comparable to minimum wage. I think your last caller said that, you know, they don't have certain labor agreements. They don't have anything. China's purely a communist state. They can get, they can pretty much do anything that they want in benefit of them just creating, you know, a profit. So when you have corporations that are doing that, where do these people think that these jobs are going? And it's like, are they really sincere when they believe that the tax cut rallying cry is supposed to honestly bring these jobs back? Or are they serious with that?
Yeah, well, I gotta be honest with you. If you listen to right wing talk radio, and that's all you do. If you, see, I think you're somebody who looks at all of the information. You listen to the right, to the left, to the middle, whatever. You evaluate all the information. Most of the people who I know who are Tea Party advocates are Glenn Beck fans. They listen to Beck in the Morning, Limbaugh, Hannity, the Savage, right down the list. And that's all they're hearing. And the message that those folks are preaching and have been preaching from the beginning is tax cuts always creates jobs, even though that's not true and there's no factual basis for it. But that's what they preach. And that's, if that's all you're hearing, that's what you believe. And they believe that, you know, if we just had freer markets and more deregulation and business could do whatever it wanted to do, we could compete with those Chinese. They honestly believe that. But we know that that's not possible.
It's unbelievable. And for the 8 years, and I guess that the 8 years that, you know, when Bush accomplished the tax cuts that he had, and the fact that we lost all of those jobs as soon as he left office, that's when it really just hit the fan.
8.6 million.
And then on top of it, you know, he doubles the national debt from what was back before when Reagan and his father were in office. So I don't know. It's just like, I can't believe they really believe that, but I guess they do. I don't know.
It is what it is. And this is my problem with our media structure, and which is why we need a trust-busting president. We need a Teddy Roosevelt figure to come in and break up these media conglomerates, because the message is in the hands of too few people. And when you have conservative, not even conservative, because I don't even know that Rupert Murdoch is a true conservative. He's a businessman. He sees where the profit is. He sees where he could make a massive profit and have people in Washington do his bidding for him. So he's more of a businessman, I think, than a conservative. But at the end of it, when the message is in the hands of a handful of people, This is what you get, this kind of groupthink.
Well, here's what I wanted to ask and see, because this is the way I feel. If President Obama even remotely goes with what David Axelrod was saying about this, compromise, which is not a compromise, it's a Republican takeover on the tax cut discussion, why does President Obama say, you know what, I don't even want or care about 2012. I'm not even going to think about that. I'm going to sit here and put the vote in this lame duck session, every single hypocritical thing that the Republicans can possibly be for. I mean, every single thing they should bring it to the table. The tax cuts, just bring it all to the table on a singular vote and let the people see, the American public see, that the Republicans are bluffing. They are lying about this. And the president sitting there talking about we can't afford the middle class tax cuts. I personally, in my opinion, if you were doing well when Clinton was in office, and I think a lot of people were, and you have a job today, it's not going to kill you to pay taxes. Someone said, they made the snide comment. They said, you know, well, somebody making minimum wage, if you take away their tax cut, that means, you know, $900 to $820. I said, anybody that makes minimum wage knows darn well that they don't pay any taxes
right.
at the end of the year. You know, come on. Be honest when you're talking about this stuff. And why doesn't the president come out and say, listen, we have two wars. We have 5,000 soldiers that died to protect and honor our country without any question at all. They went and did their jobs, and we're spending $200 million a day, and we're sitting there crying about tax cuts. It's unreal. And 10% unemployment. I don't understand if these, I don't know. I think the messaging is so far gone, and I even question liberals, not the workers, not the unions, the liberals that take one issue. They always take one issue, and whatever the president doesn't do on that one issue, oh my goodness, all the troops didn't come home from Iraq. That's it. Obama's done.
Yeah, I'm not going to vote. I'm staying home. Yeah, I heard that a bunch. But it's usually on really dumb issues, not even a true stance like the one you just pointed out, because I think the whole thing with Afghanistan now just has me flipping mad, but doesn't mean I'm going to stay home and not vote for the guy. But here, you've laid out a bunch of interesting points, and that's why we do this program, to be able to give people, and I take all callers. I want the Tea Party people calling in. I want ultra-conservative folks calling in and having the discussion that needs to be had. In which direction is this country going to go?
Absolutely. The last thing, the movie Fair Game. And I know I called last time about this, and I just want to say it again. Again, the movie was, I thought it was a phenomenal movie. They used a lot of real live clips and a lot of real live news clippings of exactly what went on. This is not fiction. This was the truth. And to hear, and I don't know if you saw the interview with Rachel Maddow, but to hear Jon Stewart give credence, actual credence, to George Bush's go-to-war message, that WMDs wasn't really the only thing, it just makes me crawl. It's like, I can't believe that you're going to sit there and have that perspective when as many people sort of got turned on to you to listen what you have to say. And that was his response to the lead up to the war. And I always say this too, not only did 5,000 American soldiers die, but about 100,000 Iraqi civilians died, 60 to 100,000, whatever you want to take your number at.
Right.
What kind of society do we think we are that's okay in the world? I mean, for anyone that really truly was upset and angry about 9/11 and the whole, you know, phrase that they hate us, we just went over there and killed 100,000 innocent people with our war that was, you know, well, who knows if it was justified or not.
Well, I don't think it was, but I get your point. Christian, I appreciate the call, buddy. As always, great talk. Thanks. I got to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-RICK. 520-7425. What do you think? Right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, in the last thing we were talking to Christian here, what gets me is that he's right. There are so many people who bought into this idea that, tax cuts create jobs. If we give the wealth class, if we give them all the money, that somehow it will rain down on us. It'll trickle down. And then those of us lowly folks at the bottom, us working people, the people who go to work and punch a clock every day, we will somehow benefit from that. We will be whole and we will be well kept because our wealthy benefactors will spread that. Has it happened? Have you seen this? Yeah, it didn't work during the Reagan years. Didn't work during the Bush years. But that's their proposal now. That's the pledge. That's what the Republicans have pledged to do. More tax cuts for the very wealthy. And you look at this Cat Food Commission, the Bowles and Simpson with their, we're going to raise the age of Social Security. We're going to modest cuts, extremely modest cuts to the defense budget. But you working people, get ready, because here it comes. And massive tax cuts for corporations and wealthy individuals. You figure that out. Explain to me then how that's supposed to work. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Politico had an interesting story today. In the 2010 midterms, Crossroads GPS, the American Action Network, talked proudly of their political clout, spending millions across the country to buy television ads to defeat Democrats and grabbing credit for helping Republicans take the House. But now the two groups, you know, Karl Rove's group and in this American Action Network, they're changing their tune, saying that intervening in political campaigns really isn't their primary mission. No, it's not it. And you ask, well, why are they backtracking? Well, because both of them are now under pressure to spend more non-campaign money than campaign dollars or run a risk of running afoul of the IRS because of the way they filed their group. In order to keep their donors secret, Karl Rove and his Crossroads GPS and American Action Network classified themselves, Jake, as a 501c4 corporation, who a social welfare group rather than a political organization. So now they've got to go and they've actually got to, do some work that helps society. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to do it at all. And, So they're trying to figure out how to get around that. But they claim, since they're going to be doing some of these, you know, attack health care and attacking financial regulatory reform, somehow that's good for society. I mean, are we living in the rabbit hole or what? When they spent, I mean, Rove's group spent $75 million claiming to be a social welfare agency, you know, concerned with the social welfare, to get Republicans elected who will then slash, burn, destroy government and tear everything down. And they're somehow claiming that they're a social welfare agency?
So they violated the law. They don't to hide?
Not yet.
Hide.
Not yet. They've got a year. They've got to spend more money in the next year than they did on the campaign, which isn't going to happen, and they're going to try and figure out how to finagle the rules a bit.
What about disclosure?
See, that's the thing. If they change, then they may have to disclose. But if they don't, you know, no disclosure. Which to me, the honest, the rational person says, I don't care what you're doing. We should know who the man behind the curtain is. And I don't care what side of the issue, right, left, center, up in the sky, underground, whatever. We should know who it is who's behind the message. Doesn't that seem rational to you? Doesn't it seem logical that when someone puts Americans for Prosperity on an ad, that you should know that it's the Koch brothers, the billionaire gas people who are funding this feel-good ad or this attack ad? Don't you think you should know that? And look, you know, I've had people say, labor unions do it. Yeah, and you know what they do? They put their name on it. This ad brought to you by the AFL-CIO or brought to you by this union or that union. They have to disclose that. In fact, labor unions have to disclose more than any of these groups. They're held to a much higher standard than anybody else because they got a department scrutinizing every single report. Because there are people like Rick Berman out there and people like that T-Twit over in, at the Commonwealth Foundation who are always, always watching and on their back constantly. So they've got to be above boards. But, you know, you don't hear that on the right. I don't hear that at all. And again, I go back to what I said to Christian. What bothers me is this consolidation of media. You know, I read that 80% of everything we see, hear, and read is controlled by 6 corporations. Stop and think about that. And now you got Comcast, who wants to buy NBC Universal and consolidate that even more. It shouldn't happen. There is no way that we should allow Comcast to buy NBC Universal. No way. Just no way. Because the airwaves are our airwaves. We should have the ability to dictate who controls them. And what's worrisome to me is the more this message gets concentrated down, the more these big companies take over, the less likely you're going to hear programs like this one. The less likely you're going to hear an alternative voice. Now, our friends on the right had better watch out too. The Limbaughs and the Becks and the Hannitys, they've got to watch their behind as well, because they run the risk of not being needed anymore. Once the message is co-opted, once the corporations have taken over, and this is why I'm saying, be happy that you hear dissenting voices. You may not hear dissenting voices from the center to left as often as you'd like, but as long as you're hearing somebody dissenting, there's still some freedom in this country. When you hear happy messages and, you know, the be well, everything is fine, the world is a wonderful place, when you start hearing that kind of toning down, softening of the message, that's when you start to worry, because there's nobody thinking again anymore. All gone. And that's what worries me. Anyway, remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can watch what's going on here in the studio. You can see Jake batting his eyes and doing the dance here during the breaks at thericksmithshow.com. You can see our Ustream. If you've missed any part of the program, you can download our podcasts we do with iTunes or at thericksmithshow.com. Send me an email, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We're going to take a quick break. We're back with Mike Crossey from the PSEA. Stick around.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People.
Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Economist Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says the President's Deficit Commission appears to have largely ignored economic reality in developing the proposals it released this week. Baker says with more than 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, or having given up looking for work, the last thing that's needed are cuts that will lower economic demand. Baker says implementing the Deficit Commission's planned cuts would be like deciding that a plane with one engine already out needs the other knocked out as well. That's because the very government deficit spending that the commission wants to cut is propping up demand lacking in the private sector. Baker says the commission is misunderstanding the nature of current deficits, and that's led to a misunderstanding of the national debt burden. Baker says there's no reason the Fed can't just buy the debt and hold it indefinitely if need be. The Fed refunds debt interest to the U.S. Treasury. Baker says there's no shorter midterm deficit crisis, and he says Social Security has nothing to do with deficits, and it's a bad idea to cut Social Security because tens of millions of people depend on it for their income. And the commission, Baker says, appears never to have even considered a financial transaction tax on Wall Street that could raise $100 billion a year. Commission co-chair Erskine Bowles is on the board of Morgan Stanley. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka happily announced Thursday that the National Football League Players Association has decided to affiliate with the AFL-CIO state federations and central labor councils in NFL cities. AFL-CIO says this act of solidarity by football players is the kind of action needed to confront the issues all working people face. Grocery shoppers in parts of Washington state may want to do their Thanksgiving grocery shopping early because a strike could be on the horizon. Jesse Russell reports.
On Wednesday, 94% of voting workers gave the United Food and Commercial Workers negotiating team the power to call a strike if necessary. The strike would impact four supermarket chains who are currently involved in contract negotiations: Fred Meyer, QFC, Albertsons, and Safeway. Negotiations have been underway for more than 9 months, and they came to a standstill in late October. The specific areas of Washington that would be most impacted if a strike does become a reality would be the counties of King, Kitsap, and Snohomish. In total, the union is negotiating on behalf of 25,000 employees. Washington State hasn't seen a major grocery worker strike in more than two decades, and the last one stretched for nearly 3 months.
Production on season 11 of popular reality TV show The Biggest Loser came to a halt Wednesday as members of the crew walked off the job to demand a union contract. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees is supporting the workers who are seeking health care and pension benefits. According to Hollywood Reporter, who broke the story, the workers find it ironic that they're working on a show about living healthy, yet they aren't offered a health care plan. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't have a phone? Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Nobody never got nothing that didn't raise a voice and push. Like the steel worker in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Chicago, janitor in Mississippi. From the sweatshops of L.A. to the fields of Mission Flats, there's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
Well, you know, right like now, that's what we're going to have to start doing. Business feels emboldened. The right-wing attack groups feel emboldened. The International Chamber of Commerce, they feel emboldened to go after the hard-fought gains and the promises that have been made throughout the generations. And I got to tell you, the time for organization is now, absolutely right now. I've got Mike Crossey on the line. He's a vice president over at the Pennsylvania State Education Association. PSEA.org is the website. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you having me on.
You know, I keep hearing this talk about the pensions, and the guy over at the Tea Party think tank over there at the Commonwealth Foundation pulling out the rest of his hair over you know, people's pensions. It's nuts to me.
I haven't heard what he has said lately, but they have had the wrong approach on this issue all the way through. I know that PSEA leadership and our members have worked with the leaders of the General Assembly and the Governor's Office to craft the bill, House Bill 2497, that we believe solves the pension issue for the taxpayers and protects the benefits and retirement security of state employees throughout the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, what he said is you're stealing food out of the mouths of his grandchildren. That's what he said. Wow. You know, just because you want your members to have a reasonable pension, the pension that they were promised, you're stealing from his yet to be born grandchildren.
Wow, it's a shame that it's a shame that he feels that he needs to go into that kind of inflammatory language. We've refused to engage in that. We don't think it's healthy for the state of Pennsylvania. We don't believe that the type of campaigns that were put on around the state and around the nation were healthy for American democracy. And we're going to continue to work to solve the problems without attacking people or, doing things that we know are dangerous and harmful to the average citizen.
Let's talk about the problem for a second.
Absolutely.
How did we get here? You know, I keep hearing all this rhetoric being thrown around. There's all this money that now that the teachers and the state workers are owed because, honestly and truthfully, they gave up wages. They gave up benefits so that they can have a secure retirement when they get older. Now we're hearing folks saying, well, you know, those are too generous. How did we get here?
We got here very, very simply. Back when Governor Ridge was elected governor, he had done what the Tea Party people want to do now. He said that I'm going to get elected and I'm going to give everybody a tax cut. And what he did was he looked at the pension fund and he decided in his administration let me go back for a second and say how our pension fund works. Our pension fund works, and it's very different than a lot of the private pension funds in that every public school employee contributes. In my own case, it's 7.5% of every paycheck goes to my pension contribution. So we pay for our pension. And the way our pension is supposed to work is that the state and the school districts come together and they match our contribution. And that has worked since the pension fund was first created. In the year 2000, when Governor Ridge got elected, our pension fund was a 123% funded. It was one of the best run pension funds in the country. Very simply, defined benefit plans work,
yep.
And that was proof of it. When Governor Ridge got elected, he was looking to give people a tax break. The tax break he gave them was he said to school districts and he said to the state of Pennsylvania, we don't need to make our share. We don't need to pay our share. Their system's overfunded. So in the year 2000, even though every public school employee paid their fair share into the pension fund, the employer side, the state and the school districts combined, paid in 0%. In year 2001, they paid in 0.18%. And since then, they have underfunded the system. This year, they're paying in 5.78. They're supposed to be paying in 8%. That's the normal cost of a pension.
Right.
This year, they're paying in 5.78%. So they have consistently, as a matter of fact, in the last 10 years, the employer side has underfunded by half of what they're supposed to have paid in. We have actually paid in double. The employees have paid in twice as much as the employer has paid in. So we've got 10 years of underfunding from the employer side. And on top of that, we had two serious recessions in this decade. In the 2001, the dot-com bubble burst. The system, took a serious hit at that time. And what the state did then, and I can't blame the current administration, I can't blame the current legislators, what they did back in 2001 was they re-amortized the thing. And they said, well, let's take all the gains we've had over the last 10 years, use them to keep our numbers and our contributions artificially low for the next 10 years. And we'll pay this bill in 2012. And what they hoped would happen is they just kicked the can down the road for another generation. What they hoped would happen was that returns over the next, decade would bring the fund back up to where it needed to be. And the fund was actually doing very, very well. In 2007, things were really starting to turn around. Then this recession hit. And this recession, as everybody in the country knows, is the worst recession we've had since the Depression.
Right. Let me ask you this.
With two recessions and underfunding the system is where it is.
Let me ask you this. Where would we be had the state funded at the same level that the employee put into the pension?
We would have been very, very close to being where we need to be right now. We would still have a bit of a hole because of the two recessions.
Right.
But the first recession would have been gone by now, and we would have had to deal with climbing out of the hole for the second recession the same as everybody else is. So it's a combination. 60-some percent of the hole that we are in now is a combination of underfunding and the two recessions.
Yeah, because I'm looking at this, and you use the word overfunded. And
right.
I'm sorry, I don't buy into the overfunded model. I think you should pay into it, and it's there for the long haul. It's there for 50, 60 years to make sure that the fund is long-term reliable. So
exactly.
By saying we're overfunded, hey, let's have a big party, let's send out cash and make everybody think we're great tax-cutting Republicans and tax-cutting Democrats, this is the hole we've put ourselves in. And
exactly.
I remember going back to the discussion about the rainy day fund. You had legislators saying, you know what, we don't need the rainy day fund. That's the people's money. We should divvy that back out. But, boy, when we had this crisis, it was nice to have a little bit of cushion to fall back on.
Yes, it was.
And I see the same thing for this pension situation. And what infuriates me is back then, I don't remember anybody screaming about this underfunding at all. I don't remember any news media really covering it. I don't remember it.
No, I know. We sent letters over to legislative leaders at the time saying, you know, this is a problem. We should deal with it now. It's not a major problem, but we should be dealing with this now. We should be funding the system the way it should be funded. And, you know, and then, to be honest, you know, after that, it pretty much fell off of everybody's plate. You know, it truly did. It fell off of everybody's plate. Everybody knew this spike was coming. Like I said, what they did was they kicked this can down the road to 2012. And one of the reasons why we're so interested in House Bill 2497 and House Bill 2497 passing on Monday, which is when it's coming up for a vote, is that this will save the taxpayers from a $3 billion bill in 2012. This new bill, House Bill 2497, has a built-in schedule in it that allows all the unfunded mandate to be paid for over the next 25 or so years.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're putting together a reasonable schedule of payments. It's pretty similar to as if, you know, if you had a credit card and you didn't, you know, kept spending and you didn't pay the bill for 10 years and then say, well, what do I do now? Well, now then you start paying the normal cost, what you have to pay, and you start paying extra to pay off the unfunded liability. That's what we're asking them to do in 2497.
Well, isn't that really the point of a defined benefit plan, that the individual – because if I listen to Briette and I listen to the Commonwealth Foundation, you know, they're saying that $3 billion that you're talking about, well, that's nothing. That's not real savings. That's just something that was invented by pushing it down the road and stealing from my grandchildren's mouths.
I think that's just silly rhetoric. I'd much rather deal with reality. And reality says we've got a bill. Let's come with a reasonable way to pay the bill. And at the same time, let's give people the retirement security they deserve.
I'm right there with you. But shouldn't the conversation we really be having is that this crisis was not something that the teachers were part of? This is not something that the working folks of this state were part of. This was, in essence, a crisis that we had nothing to do with, but we're now going to reap the pain and the suffering and the belt tightening because of it.
Exactly. I mean, this is because of the state and the school districts underfunding. And I'm not blaming the school districts a whole lot on this. They paid what they were told to pay by the state.
Right.
You know, so it wasn't like they purposely said, well, we're going to underfund this. But the state did. The state knew this bill was coming, and the state should have set the rate that school districts had to pay at a higher level. and they kept the rate artificially low for this 10-year period. So we've got 10 years of underfunding on their side, plus the two recessions. Obviously, none of the working people that I know contributed to this recession. I mean, that's a Wall Street phenomenon.
And I say we get them to pay for it.
I have no problem with that, but at the same time, I think if we can get 2497 passed, it's a reasonable plan. It protects the taxpayers from a big hit in 2012 and puts together a cost-saving system that gets this bill paid for.
Well, I had a friend of mine who looked at it, and he said, well, I want there to be a defined contribution plan for future employees. And I gotta be honest with you. When I hear Tom Corbett talk about this, and I hear some of my Republican friends talking about what they want to see happen to the teachers' pension fund, to me, what it really is it's dividing your membership, but it's dividing the teachers between folks who have a defined plan and folks who are going to be stuck with one of these 401k kind of things that are going to be, more expensive in the long run because we're destroying the defined benefit plan.
And you're 100% right. And if I can, let me talk about that for just a second. There are three states who did that. Three states went to a 401k defined contribution system for new employees: Alaska, Nevada, and West Virginia. It was such a disaster that they have come back. West Virginia and Nevada have already come back to a defined benefit plan. Alaska currently has legislation in to convert back to a defined benefit plan. What they found and what the research, not from us, not from the union, but from the National Institute of Retirement Security, what the research says is that the cost of running two systems, the defined benefit plan for current employees and a defined contribution plan for new employees, actually will cost the taxpayers 46% more.
Wow.
So we're saving the taxpayers money by saying, let's keep everybody in the same system. It actually saves people money. Now, we did compromise, and we worked with the legislative leaders to create a plan that rolls the system back. It lowers the multiplier in the pension plan for all new employees. And there's also some other changes in there. For new employees going into the system, the same as the legislators are rolling back their pension benefit,
right,
for new members of the legislature. But at the same time, the 401k was never designed to be a pension program. The 401k, the numbers come from an IRS code.
Yep.
It was designed as a special perk for highly paid, big-time executives in the business world. And then gradually what they've tried to do is they've tried to say, well, you know, this should replace defined benefit pension plans and we'll let the employees. What it does is that shifts the risk from the employer and the pension plan to the employee.
Yep. And what it does also is it puts your average Joe working class employee, keeps him looking at Wall Street and hope having some instant Wall Street success. So we get Wall Street type senators into power. We get Wall Street apologists there in Congress. And look where we are.
Right. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want my money in Wall Street over the last couple of years. Nope. I wouldn't want my retirement security there.
Let me ask you the last question I have for you. A lot of people have been saying this bill's unconstitutional because of this independent fiscal office. Curious your thoughts.
My thoughts is the bill is constitutional. I have seen that. I believe it was the Legislative Reference Bureau that said that they questioned the constitutionality of the bill because it's got an amendment to it, the fiscal office, that's not germane to the bill. Our position on that is we need the House members to come back and vote for concurrence and vote to accept the bill. One, the Reference Bureau, their opinions are not binding. We think that the legislature should come back, solve this problem for the taxpayers, vote for the bill. If they don't think that section of the bill is constitutional, they can take that provision next year to court and try to sever that fiscal office out of the bill. But my opinion and the opinion of our staff and our researchers have looked at it,
we believe it's constitutional, and we're hoping the legislators come back and solve this problem for the taxpayers and vote yes on Monday.
What should everybody do Monday morning?
Monday morning, everybody in Pennsylvania that cares about pensions and working families should call their legislators and tell their legislators vote yes on concurrence for Senate Bill 2497 with the amendments that have been added by the Senate.
All right, we will make sure we do that. Mike Crossey, Vice President of PSEA, PSEA.org is the website. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Look forward to having you back soon.
All right, thank you, Rick. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
If you were injured at work, do you think you need an attorney? You probably don't. To protect yourself, you do need to know your rights. Retain control. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Hi, Rick. This bill that they want to pass on Monday, basically what it is, it's a walk-away bill for the legislature. That bill is going to allow them to cap how much money per year that they have to put up at around 5 or 6% max. And what it does is they're going to deplete the current pension fund down to 60-something percent at some point because of that.
And what do you think is going to happen then? Because as I'm reading it, I didn't see that.
Yeah, well, I read it, and what I read was that I have the original report prepared by the legislature some years back where it said starting in 2012, they plateau at about 30% of the current labor cost they need to put into that pension fund to maintain the solvency level at its current level. They aren't going to do that. And so they put in this, that the maximum they have to put in any given year for the next so many years is 5 or 6%.
So let me ask you. Let's say we don't pass this on Monday, which some people are thinking that's going to happen. We don't pass it. What then?
Well, this new legislature that's coming in, these geniuses in the Republican Party, can figure out where they're going to get 30% more money without raising taxes. Because if they don't, it's going to collapse.
And I would say that's what they want.
Well, I don't know if they want that or not, because I don't think they know what that means.
Well, I mean, if you buy into the anti-government sentiment that you hear from most on the right, that kind of a failure, that kind of a catastrophic failure would be right up their alley.
Well, then what they need to do then is they probably need to start working on their telecommuting skills, because they're going to have to sell off all those stinking buildings in Harrisburg to pay their debt.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those scenarios where there are no really good options, in my opinion. They've created a crisis. And they have created this crisis, and now we have to clean up. You and me.
Well, I know a pretty good fix for it, really.
What is that?
Well, basically, you look at the operating cost of the legislature on an annual basis, and you shut that down and divert that money into the pension fund until the bill is paid. So So you tell the legislature to go home, and when the pension fund is paid back what it's owed, then you can come back, or else come and work for free.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, I mean, basically that's it. But what they're messing around with is a collapse, and I don't think any of them have any idea how calamitous it's going to be. The first thing that's going to happen if they don't handle it is everybody like me is going to retire in a day.
And that would be a bad thing. That would be a bad thing for not only the state, but it would be a bad thing for the pension fund because it would deplete those resources almost immediately.
That's right.
But, and you wouldn't have the time to recover from the Bush collapse of 2008.
That's it. That's what they're playing with. So I don't think it matters if it passes or not. I don't think they got the cojones to go into that battle. These guys basically are pretty spineless. They're pretty good with a slogan on TV, but I don't think they got the balls to ride this thing into the abyss. You know what? A lot of bullets could be flying downtown.
Yeah. Well, let's not go there. I'm actually in a good mood tonight.
You know, that's where we're at, Rick. That's where this country's at. That's where this society's at right now. I mean, we're on the ropes. I mean, how many people we got whose unemployment compensation is running out?
Yeah, and at the end of this month, you're going to see a couple million more people kicked off the rolls.
Right, and so where are all the jobs? I mean, they government has got the security it was looking at. I mean, the Wall Street, they were looking for security. They got it. Their people are in. How come they haven't opened the valve? They ought to be hiring left and right. There ought to be help wanted signs all over Harrisburb.
There should be.
There should be.
I'm saying 6 months, full employment.
Right. I mean, they said as soon as we got it, we're going to let the money flow. We're going to, you know, refire the mills. Life will be good. I'm not seeing it, Rick.
Well, you know, they're on holiday right now, so they need to take a little break. When they come back, everything will be wonderful.
Yeah, tomorrow, mañana. I've heard that for years. No, but I don't see that passing this bill does anything other than let the legislature take another walk away. I think they ought to do it. I think they ought to say, you've got this obligation, you pay it. And if that means you have to shut down the legislature or have it meet for 90 days every 2 years, you can divert all that money to pay that bill. It's real simple.
Interesting thought, Mike. As always, interesting thoughts. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks so much. You know, look, at the end of the day, again, this is a crisis that I didn't create, you didn't create. It's an interesting idea, shut down the legislature. We hear that often. Is it ever going to happen? No.
It's sort of for the Republicans now.
Never going to happen.
They have the power, but if that happens, they could pay a dear price long term.
Did you see the story out of Arizona, the Arizona Republic, the Maricopa County, the big sheriff there, Joe Arpaio, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Yeah.
Evidently, he's misappropriated about $80 million. They're not quite sure what he did with it. He's been running dual books, you know, hiring staff over here. I don't think he's put any in his pocket. I don't think that's the claim. But, you know, again. You know,
does the Attorney General file charges?
They're looking into it. The county supervisors are looking into it. There's an investigation going on. They're saying that he misappropriated some funds, and they're looking into it. And somebody's actually talking jail time if he's found guilty.
I mean, that guy's out of stage casting, isn't he? He could be the sheriff 100 years ago.
So my thought was, boy, I wonder how he would like the accommodations at the Maricopa County Jail.
Put him in one of his tents.
One of his tents. So there with Charles Barkley, who said, "That's terrible. That's terrible.
Terrible. Terrible." If Charles wants to seriously run for politics, he has to take some enunciation classes.
No, because I think he's going to run down in Alabama. I think that's
correct.
Isn't that where he's from, Alabama?
Yes, and he's also a Republican.
Hey, you know, I think they'd vote for him in a heartbeat. Did you see the big TV show, The Biggest Loser? Their production crew said, you know what? We want a union contract. We want to make a decent living. This show is making buku bucks. We'd like some of it. well, they walked off the set. So no more Biggest Loser? I don't know. NBC is not saying. The production company not saying. They declined comment. But IATSE, the people who are representing them, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, they represent some 110,000 workers in the entertainment industry across the country. They confirmed that, yes, their members went on strike. Their president, Matt Loeb, said this is a top-rated primetime television show, and the crew remains unified. The strike is the result of a unanimous decision by members of the production crew that they get a contract similar to others who work on other programs like this production. And we are resolute in getting it for them. And good for them. You know?
So that's the first contract.
Yeah. Good for them. You know,
absolutely.
And this is what it's going to take. It's going to take more of this. It's going to take more people, you know, sticking together. And I give them credit. Granted, I've never watched the show. But, you know, some people don't. Did you see the Supreme Court refused today to block the enforcement of the military's controversial don't ask, don't tell policy? Kind of makes you wonder. The High Court denied a request from the gay rights group Log Cabin Republicans to halt the policy while the federal courts make the decision on the case. And that's probably the best thing.
Well, here's the thing about when you get into the political end of it. Isn't it amazing that the Republicans always say we have to have a respect for our military, yet, and you correct me if I'm wrong, there's a pretty good sentiment now that they want to get away from that. Some of the top generals are in favor of eliminating that. I mean, those are the people who have to deal with the problems day in and day out.
Yeah, again, you know, it's just keep your nose out of other people's business. I don't care. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this.
With the media's preoccupation with Tea Party politicking and with the full force of raw corporate power suffocating our democracy, you probably haven't heard that many beacons of progressive hope are shining brightly from America's grassroots. These efforts show that well-organized alley cats can defeat the big money of the fat cats. Check out New Jersey, where the state AFL-CIO is not merely getting its rank-and-file members to support good candidates, but to become candidates. For the past dozen years, Jersey's Federation of Working Families has been recruiting, training, supporting, and electing its own members to state and local offices. In a state where campaigns routinely cost millions of dollars, the AFL-CIO spends a modest $250,000 a year to run a political boot camp that schools ordinary folks to be successful candidates. More than 160 of New Jersey's current office holders, including the state Senate president, are union members elected through this grassroots program. They learn the how-tos of speaking, media outreach, fundraising, and other basic democratic skills, all focused not merely on winning, but on enacting public policies to advance the middle class. The AFL-CIO president says, "We started with zoning boards, school boards, councils, then mayor, freeholder, and then senators and assemblymen. We take our members and apprentice them in the field of politics, just as we apprentice them in their own crafts," he says. The result is that labor no longer is a hapless outside group trying to persuade corporate-backed office holders to do the right thing for workaday people, but is now an inside player with real power to help set the state's policy agenda. This is Jim Hightower saying, why not do this in your state? For information, go to njaflcio.org and click on COPE.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
The Blue Bloods see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Somebody's watching you like it. Somebody's watching you. Do you care?
I do. I care. Do you? I looked at the Patriot News front page today. Right there on the front page. A park in Carlisle, cameras will be watching. And the folks that they asked seem to be thrilled about it. Turns out they're going to put 15 eyes in the sky to watch this Memorial Park in the Carlisle area. I don't know that I'm thrilled with having cameras everywhere. I understand it's a higher crime area. There are some undesirable elements, but I'm not quite sure that I'm thrilled with having cameras for low-level law enforcement. Isn't that why we hire policemen? Instead of spending $270,000 on cameras? You know, I understand the rest of the globe, you know, terrorism, they've scared us into accepting cameras everywhere and that our lives are going to be on film because we've already given up on most other things. I was reading one of these technology things. I know our producer's going to lose his mind because I'm going to sound old and angry. But one of these magazine articles said that, you know, when your kids go online and they go to Facebook and they do all these things, that you pretty much you let them, but you join in. And one of the people said, well, isn't that an invasion of the child's privacy? And the woman wrote back, said, there's no such thing as privacy anymore. You're on the Internet. There is no more privacy. And that's kind of where we're going, what position we're heading towards. And I don't like it. So if it makes me sound old and angry, I don't think I like it. And I don't like the idea of someone saying, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care that they're watching? I just don't like those cameras all over the place. And you may disagree. I'm just not thrilled with it.
I understand exactly what you're talking about. And maybe it annoyed me, and maybe I didn't allow it to really bother me that much. But more and more and more, you look at these advancements in technology, and there is an absolute intrusion into your private life. And not only is it an intrusion into your private life, other people who are utilized, cell phones, for instance, there's nothing worse than being at a movie.
Now you're sounding old and angry.
No, there's nothing worse than being in a movie and you have someone on the side, and to be fair, it's mostly younger people. They're over there talking to them, yeah, I'm at someone's great movie. I mean, talk about invasion of my...
No, that's just being rude. That's not
it's
an
being
invasion.
Call it what you want. Rude, ill-mannered.
I know you're used to those silent movies.
Now, that's just not nice. but seriously.
I get what you're saying.
Everywhere you go, and it's the same thing with Facebook. Oh, you know, they encourage you. Oh, it's a wonderful thing.
It is.
You ought to get on it. And
I am.
And I understand the value. But I also understand, as you said, there are no secrets.
So,
and
you know,
you got to watch what you put on there.
And I'm resisting. I'm one of those people who resists. I saw this story in the paper that they're going to put 15 more cameras at a cost of $270,000 up, and I go, you know, I'm not thrilled with that.
I guess, was there some serious crime there? Did someone
did they have some problems?
Did they have some federal money that they didn't know what to do with?
There's some problems that, you know, are the cameras going to be a deterrent? No, because what they're going to do is they're going to stand under it, or they're going to go where the cameras aren't. They'll move to another area. I say this is what policing is for.
Are you talking about assaults? Are you talking about robberies?
I think mostly drug dealing and, you know, some little gang violence. Look, Carlisle is not Compton. We're not talking about the Crips and the Bloods going at it. But
they'll just
they do have some problems.
If it's serious, I mean, that kind of stuff, they'll just move elsewhere.
Yeah, you know, there are people who are rolling into hoopty down the mean streets of C-Town. Doing a Detroit lean.
Well, I mean, we shouldn't minimize it, but on the other hand, I know what you're saying. What was it, an overreaction?
No, I think it's just, you know, hey, we got some money. Let's put some cameras up. Simple stuff. And speaking of, you know, cameras and the evil eye, this past summer, Arizona became, you know, one of those places that everybody looked to. They began the implementation of its draconian new immigration law, SB 1070. Now, a new study from BBVA Bancormer Research, you figure that out, using data collected by the U.S. current population survey, found that as many as 100,000 Latinos may have left the state in the time periods between when the law was enacted and October of this year. The problem is, if you read the study, that it doesn't say that the people left because of the law. It just says they left. And, you know, you look at the fact that during the time frame that they looked at, our economy was collapsing. So people were leaving. You know, it talked about this mass exodus, but it had nothing to do with the law. It had everything to do with the conditions were bad. There weren't jobs available. But it's a nice talking point. So when the right-wing people start throwing out, see what happens when you pass tough laws? Those illegals, they go home. Uh-uh. They didn't go home because of that. They went home because there was no job. The job that they had come for had dried up, and they went back. Which is why I say again, on the immigration front, don't worry about the worker. Worry about the employer. Go after the source. Simple stuff to me. Simple stuff. Did you know Florida got a new governor?
Yes.
A guy named Rick Scott.
Yes.
He blames Obama for everything. Everything in the world is Obama's fault. But yet he seems to be doing better now, financially, of course, than he was under George W. Bush. According to his last three tax returns, before the election, a Tampa Bay newspaper reported that the tax records portray a man who, like more and more out-of-work Floridians, because he doesn't have a job, because he, you know, that whole little thing with the healthcare company there. He earns no wages. But unlike most of the state's 1 million unemployed, Scott earned millions of dollars from a long list of investments. His adjusted gross income for 2009 was $7.87 million, more than double what he made in 2008 during Bush's last year. Not only did his income grow under Obama, he also paid less federal tax. He paid 13%. 13% on $7.87 million. Now, the year before, of course, when he made half of that, he paid 16%. You figure that out, because I can't. His best year was 2007, near the height of the stock market, where he made $13 million and paid 15% federal tax. And you look at the fact that here's a guy sitting by the pool, collecting his dividend checks, paying virtually nothing. And we're talking about giving him more tax breaks. Because he's part of this 2%. He's part of the 2% who would get the massive tax breaks from the Bush years. Do you really think this guy needs it more than the person who lost his job is on unemployment? I mean, this is the contrast that you have to make. We have a finite amount of resource. We have a pie, and it's only so big. And the question is, how do we divvy that pie? Do we give such large slices to the top 2% that those at the bottom go hungry? I say not. Look, you know, I'm looking at this from a sane, rational position. We're talking about cutting grandma's Social Security. We're talking about massive cuts to Medicare. We're talking about a number of things that are going to affect the working class. A retirement age that's going to jump up to 69, possibly 70, who knows. Yet we're still going, $700 billion for the top 2%? Sure, yeah. And there doesn't seem to be any argument on that. That's what makes me shake my head and wonder, what is mainstream America thinking? You know, what, how do you justify that? Because I'm not getting it. I would think we would be in the streets saying, what? You give $700 billion to someone like Rick Scott, who paid 13% tax on almost $8 million. We're gonna burn that place down. We're going to burn it down. But we don't see that kind of anger.
And here, well, you know, Rick, you say you don't see it, but I think there is anger out there. And I think it's deep-rooted. I think some people can't maybe express it. But if you think about what's going on in this country, we're funding two wars. Huge tax breaks to the wealthy. Now we're talking about extending that. Loss of jobs in excess of 11 million. I mean, is it any wonder now that why we are where we are, deeply, deeply in debt? And people basically look at the government and say, wow, you people just, you can't function. You can't do your job. We have a government that's ineffective, totally ineffective. And there's a, and again, to be fair to people, a lot of people don't quite understand everything going on, but they understand that the government is totally ineffective and they have an inability to reduce spending. But there's a way to reduce spending. You then don't turn around and penalize the very people who are victim of failed policies and ask them to pay for the mistakes of the people in power.
Okay, you used one of their frames. We need to cut spending. What do you cut? What does Jake Long cut?
Well, I mean, where do I cut it? I think one place, first of all, he looks seriously at the two wars we're fighting, which I agree with you on. Second of all, within the defense appropriations bills that have been passed, you and I both know, and I seriously do believe this, that we can cut and cut pretty good amounts of money and still be safe, still have a very strong military, still be able to defend this country.
Those are people's jobs.
Now, wait a minute.
No, I'm just curious.
Wait a minute.
I'm just saying.
But there's a lot of fat there.
Right.
The fact that they're overcharging for certain items, the fact that, well, here's a good example. You and I both know when there's a defense procurement bill coming up, and you're talking about let's say a tank, okay, and the Pentagon says, well, we need about 1,000 of them, and it depends where those tanks are being built, depends how powerful that congressman or senator is, they might wind up with 2,000, even though the Pentagon didn't ask for it and didn't need it. Those are the kind of things that I really do believe that there's a lot, there's fat in the defense contract. Now, I know what you're saying. Long term, the solution is put people back to work. When they're working, they're paying taxes. That's part of the solution. But at the end of the day, I think there has to be some cutback somewhere. I think the Defense Department is illegitimate. Place to look.
And you gave me an answer. First cut is that $700 billion going to the top 2%. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back to wrap this up. Stick around. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out our website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me there at rick@therickSmithShow.com. I got an email during the break from Mike. He says, the next time someone says, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care if they watch? Ask that person how they feel about a camera in the bathroom. Hey, you're not doing anything wrong. Why should you care? Okay, good point. Anyway. A new poll out indicates that just under half of all Americans are happy about the results of last week's midterm election. Already, it's under half. Last week, you know, 57% of the people were thrilled. Oh, boy, couldn't be happier. Oh, happy days. Now I think folks are looking at the possibilities of what may happen and going, well, I better rethink this. Just a little bit. I know I've got some friends who voted for Corbett who are starting to go, well, I don't know what I'm hearing. Don't know. The no tax thing sounded great until they woke up and realized it meant no taxes on the Marcellus Shale.
I mean, come on. If you're serious about your vote and a politician says that, right away your ears should be perking up. Very few politicians can make that promise and really fulfill it and be responsible, and that's the key. This man is not a state rep. He's not a state senator. He's the leader of this state. That's a lot more responsibility. For him to say what he said, I think, was totally irresponsible.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Bernie Sanders has...